Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. What you're about to hear is a recording that I did on 25th of January 2020. And the photos that you see are photos that I took of Ronnie Casserolls. Who is Ronnie Casserolls? Ronnie Casserolls is one of the top Jewish communists in the time of the war between the blacks and the whites. This guy was a very senior member of the South African Communist Party. This is your classic Jewish communist, actually. This is exactly the kind of person that Adolf Hitler and the Nazis fought against, Jewish communism, or as they called it, Jewish Bolshevism. In fact, in the days when I had my Jewish friend, I actually raised the issue of Ronnie Casserolls, this very guy, whom you see the photo of, which I took on the 25th of January, I actually raised the issue of is this guy a Jewish communist? There was a time about 10 or so years ago when I spoke to my Jewish friend one day and I said to him, you know, didn't Adolf Hitler say something about Jews and communism? Jews being communists or involved in communism? And my Jewish friend went to great lengths over the next week to tell me that Ronnie Casserolls is not Jewish. However, as you will discover in my recordings of the 25th of January, you will hear out of the mouth of Ronnie Casserolls himself, as well as the Jews who were present at the meeting, you will hear them all talking about being Jews and Jewish. Yet my friend had gone to great lengths to tell me, no, Ronnie Casserolls, no, he's not Jewish. And his reasoning, I'll get back to the story, but his reasoning is, well, you see, he's an atheist, therefore he cannot be a Jew. And that is the line he took back then. But he's a Jew. His parents are Jewish. His grandparents are Jewish. He grew up in a Jewish community. He identifies with Jews. He's got family in Israel. And there he is, welcomed by the Jewish community. And they're all talking about we Jews. And they're also talking about we whites. So just a bit of background about this recording. The day before this, on the 24th of January, one of my very loyal supporters, a lady, sent me a message late in the evening. It was a Friday evening. She said to me, Jan, tomorrow Ronnie Casserolls is going to be at a book launch. And it's very close to where you live, and you can go there, and I'll give you the address. And I said, yeah, sure. And the more I began to think about it, the more I began to think this might be a really good idea. And I went there, and when I was there, I asked the person hosting this talk, I asked if I could take photos. And I was told, yes, you can go ahead. So I took photos, and I recorded the entire talk. And I got a chance to ask Ronnie Casserolls a question. This is actually the second time in my life that I've had a chance to talk to this Jewish communist. The last time was sometime in the period 1993 to 1995. He doesn't know about the time that I spoke to him before. But I can show you some of the stuff that I got as a direct result of my discussion with him. And One of the things that I got as a result of my discussion with him was his book, Armed and Dangerous, which had just come out, and he was boasting about it. But he also told me where to get other communist literature, which is what I was really after at the time. I must have had a 20-minute discussion with him back then. I phoned up the Communist Party headquarters in Johannesburg, and I said to them, listen, I'm a budding communist. I'm very, very interested in communism. I want to learn as much as I can about communism. The reason I said that was because I was looking for communist literature. I had heard that the communists, the South African Communist Party, has got a journal, and the journal is called The African Communist. And I wanted to get my hands on that journal because in the Communist Party journal, I wanted to see what these scum-sucking pigs have in store for us whites in South Africa. So one day I hit on the idea, let me phone the Communist Party, and back then we didn't have cell phones, we just had landlines. Let me phone the Communist Party and see if I can find out how do I subscribe to or get copies of The African Communist. Well, to my utter amazement, when I phoned them, they said, yeah, we'll put you through to someone. And they put me straight through to Ronnie Casrils. He and I had a 20-minute discussion. I kid you not. The two of us had a long 20-minute discussion. And I was saying to him, I'm so interested in communism. Where can I get literature? And he said to me, well, what you do is you go into Johannesburg and you go there, and in there at on that street corner, you'll find that little shop and you'll find all our literature there. And I went there, and in that little shop, it was filled with communist literature from all over the world. I'd never known that there were so many communist publications in the world. My jaw just about hit the floor. There was communist magazines and journals from all across the world, Europe, you name it. And it is there that I went and I got copies of The African Communist. And I managed to get a couple of copies over a period of time because I wanted to read what have these people got in store for us. And I still have those very journals that I got back then. I still have them in my possession. But anyway, here was a chance to talk to him face to face. And I went with my friend and we listened to his talk and the question and answer session about his latest book, his third book. And I was looking for an opportunity to try and ask him a question. And they didn't have much of a question and answer session, but I managed to get the first real question in. And I'd thought hard about how I'm going to phrase this thing in the hope that I can get as much information out of him as possible. And I gave him a story, and he actually went on and he started talking quite a lot. And he actually said a whole bunch of interesting things, really interesting stuff. And I did my utmost to be friendly and to try to encourage him more and to see if I could possibly get in a second question. But somebody else came and asked another question, and then they cut the rest of it short. But I did get quite a good chunk of time where he spoke and he answered my question. So what you're about to hear is the full recording of the entire session where Casrils talks about his book, where he's asked a bit about his past, etc. Now, I've sliced out portions of this previously in other videos to focus on different things, but there are still things I want you to notice. This meeting is held in a house, and you'll later hear Casrils talking about how during the time of the ANC, how he was sneaking around, how they were holding house meetings secretly with the non-whites, how the blacks, Mandela himself, etc., went and did their politics basically from house to house. and they'd have these little meetings of like a dozen people, and they'd talk about politics and the future, etc. And they did these things at a time when they were banned, because in South Africa there was a law, just like in Rhodesia, there was a Suppression of Communism Act. Communism was illegal in Rhodesia and South Africa. We did not allow communists to function. It was not like in America, where communists walk around and they're doing their communism in Congress and they're doing their communism on national TV and that kind of thing. That wasn't how it was in Rhodesia and South Africa. The whites went and they made laws saying that communism is illegal and no communist activity is supposed to take place in the country. And any organization that was a communist organization was banned. And once they started their violence, they were banned. These people were banned in South Africa. And many of them were on the run, and they were hiding and sneaking around. And the police were hunting them down. And this was how it went on for years and years. Now, here you're going to see Casrils talking about house meetings. And he says, house meetings like this, but maybe with less people. Because in that particular house meeting, there were maybe 30 people, I'd guess. There were quite a number of us there. All of the people who attended were, let's say, whites. There were no blacks there, no Indians there, no coloureds there. So the people that you had in this house meeting were white people. Because of the location and private property and all of that sort of stuff, I didn't want to go and put up photos of the faces of the people, etc. So I've just focused. The only photo that you will see is the photo of Casrils, and there's one other photo that I will show you. So you're not going to know the location, but the location is very close to where I live. It's just a couple of kilometers away. It's in a normal house in the suburbs, and if you drive past it, it'll look just like any other house owned by whites. And when you walk in there, all the people will look white. But some of the people there are Jews. Quite a lot of the people at that meeting were Jews. Then there were a bunch of English-speaking South Africans. You can hear from the way they speak, etc. And then there were probably a tiny number of Afrikaans speakers. And my friend who'd arranged this is one of them. Now, listen carefully to how these Jews talk. Because in the United States, the Jews are saying, no, we're not white. We are not white. Jews are not white. Yet they look white, okay? Because they got valuable European DNA in them, which they shouldn't have at all. And here they are turning on their own race openly and proudly, even turning on their own race in America. Now, here in South Africa, as I've mentioned to you, you get what I call the Jewish chameleon. The Jew can be this today and he can be that tomorrow. Whenever you meet a Jew, the Jew will tell you he's just like you. He's exactly the same as you. And then when he meets somebody else, he's going to tell that person he's just like him. I had a friend who was a real Christian Afrikaans guy, but he was a genuinely honest guy. He had a business, really nice guy. I dealt with him a lot, and he was really quite amazing in his honesty. And that's why I did business with him. In my case, he repaired my car and he was fantastic. He never cheated me. He did things completely correctly. He would do better work than other people. Totally honest, never a problem with him. And then one day he says to me, oh, I've got this Jewish friend and this Jewish friend is just like me. I said to him, my friend, your Jewish friend is not like you. No, Jan, he's exactly like me. He's exactly like me. I'm like, man, you don't know what you're talking about. So, in this audience, you've got whites, and Jews. There were quite a number of Jews there. And listen to the discussions. You'll see Ronnie Casrell's talking, and he'll talk about us whites. Then you'll hear some of the other people talking, and they'll also say, us whites. And what I'm trying to get across to you is, those of you who said, oh, you people in South Africa and Rhodesia, you didn't know about Jews. Well, that is because when the Jews were among us and we were living with them, they talked like this. They were talking, us whites. They're identifying as white. So you think, yeah, they're like us. They're like us. They look like us. And they say that they're white like us. And we've given them privileges just like us. Little do we know that these motherfucking dogs, that these fucking dogs are busy working with our enemies. And in this very discussion, you will actually hear some of this. You'll hear the host, the hostess, and she will talk about the time when she had a shop. Oh, I had a shop there for 27 years, and it was a bakery. And then these blacks came along. She doesn't say blacks, but the people that she's talking about, all the people that they're talking about are either blacks or Indians. Blacks and Indians were the main races that worked against the whites. The coloureds, not really. The coloureds are the only non-whites in South Africa that actually even voted for the whites after black rule. Of all the different races of people in South Africa, the non-white race that is the most loyal to the whites, or used to be the most loyal to the whites, were the coloureds. And that's because they're a mixed race. There's like that blood thing in it. And I want to stress the politics of blood, that it's actually very interesting that non-whites who've got partly white heritage are more loyal to whites than the ones who have no blood ties. And I think that's a very important thing to remember in the future. Don't knock non-whites too hard if they've got partly white descent. Because when push comes to shove, you'll find that they are more likely to side with you than like the blacks. However, the Jews who are white, and I say white because they are of European descent, because these are Jews who came from elsewhere, but they went and intermarried among whites, and they look white. That's what I'm getting at. So here you have these Jews who look completely white, and what I want you to focus on is notice how bloody friendly these people are with our enemies, with our worst fucking enemies. You'll see that they're like hobnobbing with all our enemies. They're busy, oh, you know, this guy wanted a cake, but nobody wanted to make it for them because obviously it was a cake that had maybe some ANC insignia, African National Congress insignia, or Communist Party insignia. Oh, but I said, no problem, I'll make one for you. You will hear all these things. Listen to the nature of the discussion and all these people that is being quoted by the hostess. Oh, I met so-and-so. You know, he's so amazing and blah, blah, blah. And you will see that here are Jews and they are hobnobbing and totally friendly with our enemies. These people were our enemies. These people, these leaders that they're talking about, were people who went to Russia, who went to China, who went to Cuba, who got guns, who went and talked on the world stage and said, you know, those damned whites of apartheid, put sanctions on them, you know, all that kind of stuff. These were our enemies. And here you'll see the Jews just like hobnobbing with them. They're like, oh, my friend, oh, do you know him and him? And oh, he's so amazing and blah, blah, blah. And that is what I want to get across to you, is what a bunch of treasonous scum they are. If you had to have another bunch of whites And yet to talk about those blacks, you wouldn't say, oh, Nelson Mandela, what an intellect, what a leader. You know, it's the greatest person I met other than God himself. No, no. You'll see that with these people, they are loving your enemies and they're merging with them. And I began to notice this with my Jewish friend. My Jewish friend would say to me, oh, you know, Jan, I was talking to the mayor of Johannesburg today and I've been invited to that meeting. And I'm like, what the fuck? He's my fucking enemy. He's fucking ANC. What are you fucking saying to me? And you will see these people walking around and they are so friendly to our enemies. Our enemies. And here you will see it clearly in this thing. Listen to all their different stories. Kazrils gives his reasons for why he went against apartheid. You know, apartheid, you know, when the whites do this, then the next thing is the gas chambers. That old load of nonsense there. But there are many things. Listen carefully to the discussion. Listen carefully to the things that they say. Here you've got Jews nicely relaxed and they're busy yakking away, talking their Jew crap. And it should be obvious to you, look at how friendly they are with our enemies. And that is what used to bother me about my Jewish friend towards the final years. I began to notice he's not moving away from liberalism. And then he talked to me about business that he's getting. He'll get business from a white Afrikaans guy and he'll think nothing of it. White guy giving him a lead or a customer and he thinks nothing of it. But who's he hobnobbing with and who's he really pleased to be hobnobbing with? No, the mayor of Johannesburg, and he's in with this guy and he's in with that guy and I'm going to be at that meeting and there. And I'm looking at this and I'm saying, I wouldn't even want to be present. I don't want to have a cup of tea with the mayor of Johannesburg. These are my enemies. These people were our enemies. I don't regard them as mine. I want to have nothing to do with them. And yet here they are like, oh no, no. Guess who I met, who I spoke to? The way and the tone that Ronnie Kazrils talks, he talks in quite a measured way. And his nice, soft way of talking and blah, 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 and his reasoning and so forth. Very similar to the way the Jews used to speak, especially my Jewish friend. So this will give you a bit of an idea of what I've been trying to convey to you out of just my own past experiences with these people. But here you have an actual recording where you can listen for yourself and reach your own conclusions. And you'll hear the Jew going on about, oh, these whites, you know, they're fighting these blacks. But these blacks just wanted a multiracial society. You know something? I want to bet you that those blacks didn't really want a multiracial society, some of them. And that there were blacks who were racists among them. But I think that the Jews co-opted them and said, no, 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 if you go multiracial, you'll have our support. And I will bet you that that's where that comes from. And that's why you'll see the Jews constantly. Oh, you know, Nelson Mandela, he had this vision for multiracial South Africa. If you go into some of the past history much further, there are other things I will show you where the original impetus for South Africa in 1928, the original impetus for and goal for South Africa in 1928 from Russia, from the Soviet Union, was that South Africa would be turned into a black communist republic. A black communist republic. The original statement was not that South Africa was going to be a multiracial state. It was going to be a black republic. And that's what we basically are. Despite all the yak, yak, yak about, oh, we're multicultural, we're multiracial, and you know, we've brought freedom to you. I'll show you something else. Got a little photo to show you as another exercise. So later on in this video, you're going to see a little photo And you're in for a little surprise. I'm going to show you something else from this event. The main thing is that we are talking here to a high-ranking enemy. This Jew spent and devoted his entire life to working for the downfall of whites. Yet here he is saying, oh, I'm so happy to talk to white people. They are so serious, you know, and I'm looking to engage other people. Probably translate what that Jew is saying. I'm looking to talk to other people so I can mislead them. That's my view of what he's saying.
This is our second event of the year, and I'm actually gobsmacked at the turnout, I must say. Wow, thank you all for coming. No, not you.
He's applauding you.
We've got one more coming just now, but she'll just sneak in and find a chair. Before I introduce Ronnie, I just want to put a blanket statement out there. We are not getting into an Israel discussion, okay? So we will not be discussing the existence of the state of Israel or anti-Zionism or anything like that. I'm going to avoid that topic altogether. You can get into the ANC. I'm quite happy for you to get into the ANC. Ronnie's got big shoulders. He can cope with the ANC.
I can cope with Zionism as well.
Yeah, but I can't. And I know one or two other people in this room won't be able to cope with the conversation.
But so they might be surprised because I'm not just absolutely, I'm not anti-Israel.
No, I know you're not anti-Israel. Do you have to start marching? Yeah. Off. I'll stand. Come. Off. Fine. Okay, enough. Ronnie Cashwells to the man. Welcome, Ronnie Cashwells, to the Madhouse. Welcome all the new people to the Madhouse, which you've now encountered. If anybody needs the bathroom, it's up the stairs, down the passage, first and second door on the right. If you haven't paid me, please pay me before you leave. That's the other nice thing. Hello, Ronnie Cashwells. Welcome to Life in the Garden.
Thank you. It's wonderful
to have you here.
Thanks.
Lovely book. Took me right down memory lane, having grown up in Yeovil myself. Ronnie, before I jump straight in, do you want to give us a little bit of your history after you joined the ANC? Because this is your first 21 years. So let's take just a little bit, a brief sort of, from going into exile to coming home.
Okay, sure. So good afternoon, everybody. Nice to meet you. Thanks for the invite. When I woke this morning and it was pouring with rain, the first thing I thought was, oh, there goes the cricket. And then the second thing I thought about, life, comma, in a garden, who's going to come, you see?
Yeah.
And then by 11, I thought, a little bit of sunshine, I'll check what's happening. It's a wondrous. Yeah, I love cricket.
We set up in the lounge if the weather's
bad. Okay. Anyway, yeah, but the rain sometimes just keeps people at home, except if you live in England.
Yes,
as I discovered when I was in exile, it was raining all the time back in 65, and I was married and a little boy, and we never went out at all until we noticed that people were constantly in the streets with their brollies or
shirts. No,
so, you know, we soon acted the same way. Anyway, post the book. The book ends, and it's a coming-of-age book, so, okay, we'll come back to that. But it ends in 1960, a major turning point in South Africa's history, Sharpeville Massacre. And that's when, as we discuss the book, I was drawn into doing something about this atrocity, and I became absolutely involved in politics at that stage. Supported the ANC. At that stage, I was working as a film executive director. I was only 21 or 2, but Lever Brothers Durban, they give these fine titles without much commensurate pay, that you're an executive director. And I was with them then in Durban, although I came from Joburg, went down to Durban for the job, and became very involved in Durban. With the ANC, living something of a double life. Suit and tie in the way executives dress during the day, And then in the evenings, we'd go out painting slogans, you know, down at the apartheid, or putting leaflets under people's doors, etc. Now, he became a public speaker there. So quite soon after becoming a public speaker, I was banned from speaking and belonging to any organization, and there was hardly anything left for me to do. So I signed on at Natal University in 1963. I was an athlete, so I was preparing for the Comrades Marathon, a ambition of my life from very young. And because of the special branch, I've never ever managed to run in a Comrades Marathon. I was so fit, ready to go. You know, in those days it was 31st May, the old Republic Day and so on, when the race was run. And I'm at university, running for the university team as well, when I discovered that they were looking for me. And with a number of secret hats, I had been recruited into Umkhonto weSizwe by the Mandela leadership, and met Mandela in that area. So they had got onto us, and people were being arrested. I just managed by the skin of my teeth to escape. And the ANC said, "You've got to go out and work for us abroad." So I went to Dar es Salaam. I worked for them there. In that period from MK, we were all being sent to either Egypt or Algeria for training, since I was the one white amongst all these African guys. We can't send you there, we'll send you to Russia. So I ended up going to Russia for a year, doing military training there at an incredible time in this country that was recovering from the Second World War. Back in Dar es Salaam, my wife, who had been in detention in South Africa, managed to escape with me, was pregnant, but she had a, by me by the way, but she had a British passport. So the ANC, and I can tell you they were very, very human about these things, and they basically said, you know, Eleanor's not well and pregnant, and you can get to London, Britain, you go there. And she went ahead of me, and you know, we didn't know whether we would reunite, but within a couple of months, because I was finishing some prep for Oliver Tambo, actually, they said to me, "Okay, we want to release you to go and join Eleanor in London." These guys, that generation of Luthuli and Tambo, Joe Slovo, the communist, etc., were very warm human beings. So I finished up in London, and I was there for, on the books, so to speak, with a British travel document from 1965 to 1990, and I had two kids. But after, and I was working for the ANC all the time, because from London, having this close connection with South Africa, student-wise, business, trade, sport, I was always doing clandestine work. And we recruited people, sent them back, and so forth. We were creating a presence in the country. After 76, when there was this influx of young people after the June uprising, the ANC asked me to come back to Africa to teach them politics, basically, and history, that kind of thing. There were other people able to teach them about shooting guns. It was a military thing, but I did the political side. And I spent then going back and forth to London, because again, this humane aspect was there, that we need you. In Angola, Mozambique, I was traveling around Zambia, Zimbabwe, which one was Swaziland, where we had to go put on our false noses and moustaches and disguises. But they insisted that I should be back in Britain at least twice a year to have the connection with my family. And they were able to get free tickets out of the former socialist countries, because you got those free. But it meant going from Luanda to London. So, you know, if you were going an Italian or a British flight, it's like 8 hours. The journeys we had to take, given the free tickets, was Luanda, Tripoli, Moscow, you know, overnight Moscow, and then London. So that was like 24 hours. Well, that's until 1990. And then with the lifting of the ban and the release of prisoners, exiles returning, all of that public activity. So I came back and I was home after 27 years at the age of 54. So, you know, you spend 27 years growing up in a country, but you're 27 years outside and mainly based in a very civilized, wonderful place to live is London, as you can imagine. Maybe not under Brexit and Boris now, but it's another thing. So it was really very engaging. And I actually managed to write in that period 3 books. Well, I edited a book on Bertrand Russell and selected his letters to the general public, which he loved and did really well. And then with a friend of mine, Barry Feinberg, we did basically 2-volume biography of Russell and his connection with America, which goes back to, you know, he died in 1970s or so, age 93, so it goes back, starts in the previous century. So that was a very interesting aspect. That was my writing up to that stage. I was writing, doing these kind of protest poems for the ANC. And then I was doing short stories and stuff, all about the politics.
You were very interested in English, though. I mean, it's from your school days.
I absolutely loved it. I was very lucky to have good English and history teachers. They really made the difference to my life. Anyway, back here at the ranch, as they say, I was very involved in that resurrection of the ANC and was elected to its executive committee. When the government was set up, 94, I became Deputy Minister of Defence for the first five years. And then, that's under Mandela, and then under Mbeki, I became Minister of Water Affairs and Forestry, which was actually my most lovely and exciting period to be in the villages of this country. At a time when the ANC, whatever the criticism was growing about Mbeki, was functioning and delivering. There were errors and the seeds of which you can trace from that period with Zuma and his rise after 2008. But from the period of Water Forestry Minister, I then was made for my sins by Mbeki, the head of intelligence security, which is, you know, something I wouldn't like to live again, but he couldn't trust any of these people who had been in intelligence. It was an absolute murky world, and he thought I could clean it up and get it to function in the way it should, protecting people and the country, not being involved in politics. So there was a big ruction between myself and my group there, and the general, mainly ANC, rather than the Afrikaans or the Afrikaners, was the ANC people in security intelligence who were turning it into politics, which is an absolute anathema for any state machinery, whether from police or military, intelligence, whatever it might be. But particularly in intelligence, it's so simple, because you're shrouded in mystery anyway, in secrecy. So, you know, as bad as people are, getting away with looting departments and so on, in the intelligence sector, which has this curtain over it, it's even worse. Anyway, for that reason, we saw Zuma coming to power, basically a coup against Mbeki. And I was one of 12 ministers who resigned. There was no way I was going to serve under Zuma. From that time to now, growing old, and slowing down. I've written these books, so I can call myself an author now, because it said that you need to write, have published at least 3 books before you can call yourself an author. Whoever decided that, but if you Google it or check, and Janine, who's here as a publicist, you'll find out that somehow it's how many books? You know, one, and you've done a memoir. So you're a dilettante. It's when you start getting titles that you call, like, and now I talk about myself. What do I do? And I write down writer instead of retired.
Instead of politician?
Well, I'm not a politician, but I'm active politically, socially, talking truth to power, standing up against my former colleagues and being able to criticize, which is why I, by the time Zuma came in, I was still there with Communist Party and ANC. But the extent to which they had become rotten and supported Zuma, I decided from inside, you can't really criticize. You know, comrades would say to me, what are you leaving for? You've got to stay inside. That's where it all counts. But I'd say to them, to this day, stay inside and try and fight it out. See if you can stop the rot inside. I want to speak to the people of South Africa. All our people. So I'm not a racist. I don't come in here, we're all white, I'm going to change my tune. I really enjoy talking to whites, because they're so anxious, you know, what's the future, etc. And I like doing it through writing, because in my books, they are memoirs, but I try to convey aspects of how I've seen things to people who are interested in my happening into it. Is that enough?
That's enough.
Okay.
I want to tell you a little funny story. Yeah. In the early 90s in Yeovil, Ronnie and I were discussing this just now, but in the early 90s in Yeovil, there were about 25, 27 future MPs in the run-up to elections living in Yeovil Observatory, Bellevue, that area. And I had my folks had a video shop in Yeovil for 27 years, and I had a little coffee shop in Yeovil for about 6 or 7 years. And they either used to come to the coffee shop or they used to come and get movies. And one of them was Charles Nkula.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Friends.
And he came the one day with his security and whatever. And I was a cheeky. No. He was never like that. Okay. And I was a cheeky little 23-year-old or something.
Well,
and I always used to say to my dad, what does he do? So my dad said he was a politician. So the one day I said to Charles, so what do you do? And he said, I'm a politician. So I said, so what do you do for a living? Anyway, I could see my dad. He was cringing. He was actually like, what is going to come out of her mouth next? And it's never, ever changed. And at that point, he was the Secretary General of the Communist Party.
Charles.
Yeah. Yes, yes. So, yeah, there was this little pipsqueak. But it was amazing, because we had Mac Maharaj, we had both Jane Iodues, Cheryl Baroulis, I did the caking for Joe Sober's funeral.
She was in observatory.
But another little anecdote is a woman. Before I opened the coffee shop, a woman came into the shop, and very petite little thing, and she said, I wasn't there. She said she wants a cake with half the ANC flag and half the Prevent flag. And she'd been everywhere, and nobody would make this cake for her. So, well, we'll make it, no problem. So we made it. It was a very nice little cake, sort of a beer box. We used to call them that sort of size. And she came to collect it, and I said to her, why do you want this cake? She said, because Nelson Mandela is coming for lunch. And I looked at her and I thought, who are you and why would Nelson Mandela come for lunch at your house?
Yes.
Anyway.
And it was Geraldine Fraser, my kid. Yeah.
No, it was Jane Iodues' wife.
She's
French cook, you know. Yeah. And she came to drop off a photograph afterwards of her and her mother. Her mother was here, and he was coming for lunch to meet her mother. So there was my photograph of Mandela and my cake at the art. So it was very nice. It was a very nice time to be around. It was history in the making. And now I want to go back even further. So when I was reading your book, it was part of it was delightful for me, because having grown up in Yoruba myself, I mean, we were there my whole life, virtually, until at some point. until about 35. Yoval was a colleague. And so reading your book and where you came from, I could, in my head, I knew exactly where you were if you were walking down the street. I knew exactly what the street looked like and the buildings and the swimming pool and everything. It made huge, huge sense to me. So let's talk about your grandparents. Because we have grandparents.
Can I just say something? Because it sparked this point in me. I love writing geography. So by that, I'm talking about where you're living and the environment. And then there's a question. There are people who don't know Yeovil and their streets. They're like famous rocky streets. Maybe they didn't know it. And my feeling is, it helps lay the atmosphere, and for people who know the place, just like you've said, it's fascinating. And for people who don't, it pulls them in, and the aim is to give something of the environment of the town, the atmosphere, the people, which is something that I really enjoy doing. So this is maybe, it's bragging now, the following. But I'm not an egoist, so obviously it's a bragging. But
and I'm promised to something. Oh, I don't know what. Is it a walking
talking? Don't
worry.
Wait, what?
Sorry.
What's happened?
I am walking. I'll see you in the way. What's happening?
Mark, you've got a newspaper and a pot full of shoes. Yeah. Yeah.
That's
the madhouse.
Excuse me,
this man.
I've got
to get home.
But I was just saying, you see, you're talking about reading and the love of it. And I absolutely, from an early age, adored Graham Greene. And read Graham Greene, and he puts the geography there. There's a book called The Ministry of Fear, which he wrote in the 30s, about Goode Street, Warren Street, London, which is very trendy today, which was still somewhat down at heel in the London I knew. But I could look at it through Graham Greene's eyes. There's a lot of the, you know, English literature, so there's Piccadilly Circus and stuff. And that's where that bug bit me. So when I talk about branding, showing off, one of the things that I've been so proud of, there are two writers, very eminent and academic and journalist at the same time. The one's Victoria Britton, who lives in Britain, and is a great friend of mine. The other's Professor Hugh Macmillan, who's based in Oxford now, but lived in Zambia and was with his mother when she taught Cape. And both have said to me about my early book, The Armed and Dangerous, which I'll refer to a little bit when we, in the course of memoir. So I want to talk a little bit about the importance of memoir and what memoir is, because everybody here has it in them to write a memoir. We heard Lindy talking about your life. I should say to you, you would write your memoir. But anyway, I write about Zambia, coming there for the first time in Dar es Salaam, arriving there in 65. And in talking about it, I painted a picture about Dar es Salaam, 1965. Without going into detail, a very beautiful old world Africa, you know, with the incredible vegetation and the old style hotels and spies everywhere, Cubans and CIA and church people and so on, and the African Liberation Movement. I describe that city. And Victoria Britton, who's written many books on Africa, when I became friendly with her, she said, "You know something? The way you describe Dar es Salaam, then, you're the only person who's given the snapshot of Dar es Salaam under Nyerere as the country emerges from colonial status." So, you know, I'm just pointing this out. You then feel the worth of four people recording that snapshot, which is why I go into Yeovil with that snapshot. With Macmillan, he's written a book about the ANC called The Lusaka Years. Very little's been written about the ANC and its Lusaka years, its headquarters there, where Tambo and others were working. Kaunda, of course, the host. And this Lusaka at that time was like a Karoo dorp, although the capital was Abuja. And when I arrived there from Angola, so I was in 1978, sometime like that, the thing that bowled me over, I'd lived in Angola, I'd been in Zambia, mainly London. So, you know, Angola and Tanzania are tropical. And there's nothing like anything we know here. Natal Coast a little bit, being subtropical, but the whole culture and everything else. I come into Lusaka, and the first thing I see driving in from the airport is past the railway station, which was like DR or somewhere like that. And there were all these coaches and trucks with SAR and SA Spoorweg written on there, which Zambia needed desperately, and you know, South Africa was providing that. This caught my imagination. I began writing that about the ANC office and the people there, etc.
So, are you journaling?
Was I journalist?
Journaling.
What's journaling?
Keeping notes and like a diary.
No, because it's a great pity, but because of the secrecy of our lives and the possibility that maybe you could get arrested, or even in London, not arrested by the Brits, but maybe people's houses were broken in and stuff taken. And if you were in these countries like Angola and Lusaka, you had pseudonyms. So the old people might have known me as Ronnie Caswell, but I had a different name for everybody who came in. They still call me Kumalo, which was my given name by the ANC. So one couldn't do that. I sharpened my memory in terms of maybe not having that, and then telling the stories which, like, you know, put the grooves in the mind.
Yeah.
I say this because people say to me, you know, you've got a fantastic memory, how does this happen? But anyway, Macmillan then says to me, your book's enormously important to me, Ronnie, because you're giving the picture of the ANC in 1977. You've given the snapshots. So I am a camera, is that wonderful beginning of a
historian.
Book by Christopher Isherwood. Well, it comes to the memoir issue and why I have a passion for memoirs and write. Basically, people, I know that they are my enemies, and you have plenty of enemies within your own political milieu. So I'm not talking about the old enemy of apartheid. I'm talking about people
who have been
quite close to me, who will say, God, he's so infatuated with himself, all he can write are memoirs about himself.
Have you read Charles's book, The People's War?
Yes.
I have never seen a book with so many people's names in my entire life.
Well, that's the problem.
It's like
with the
roll call of the ANC.
It's a problem with the book. When I first wrote the first memoir of the struggle, which is On the Dangerous, it's 1 o'clock, and this is getting into why you write a memoir, etc. And I give it as an example of writing a memoir for cathartic purposes. I was again on the run in South Africa in 1990, and underground. It's a time when you stay indoors during the day, and at night you go and meet people and so on. So during the day I've begun to learn how to use a computer, and it was just really a question of therapy. Writing about my background, so writing about Yeovil, and Heinemann's were very interested in publishing a memoir by me about that period. And when I gave them the first few chapters, the editor said to me, this is interesting, but it's you know, you're not writing a family album, You can't put in everybody's names. You've got to choose. And this is where you'll see with most of the memoirs of people who aren't really writers. And maybe I wasn't really a writer then. I think I am now. But, and I learned from Heinemann. They were the first publisher. And that was a really good editor. But I noticed from comrades who are writing memoirs now who aren't having professional advice, etc. And it's just these roll calls. There's too many. You have to, as this editor explained to me, when I was dealing with Smule, the Oval Boys, which I deal with here, and I think I provide about four or five names of my primary school. And the names are either, as she said to me, the editor, Ronnie. It's not the family album. So from that period, whichever period, the name must be somebody who appears and reappears through the narrative. Mm-hmm. Or if they only appear once, it's got to be because of something really relevant. You can't write, well, you know, I was at school and, you know, we had this little game with A, B, C, D, this kind of thing. And what Charles does, and it's a very useful book and quite well written. Well, you see, what's happened with him, and why I'm pleased, I have a freedom of having broken from the band, or the tribe, actually, the tribe, where I don't have to write and put everybody's name down, which is where if somebody who's still in the family can't leave anybody out.
Yeah.
And so he writes and you put in this one, that one, oh God, but I've left this one out. And it ends with this absolute, you know, lengthy, as long as you're on the list of people. And it's just a name. So what do people know? But if you write about somebody, I write about my neighbour in Elgin Court, Raymond Street, very low and middle class building, 9 flats residences. They all, except for one of those apartments, Lithuanian or Latvians, who have come over, these Jewish immigrants, maybe they second generation, although my father was born in Latvia. So grandparents, certainly all of them. But the parents now, and then my age group with kids growing up, the one exception was a Jewish guy, but he came from Glasgow. and he was a bookmaker at Church and Tate. So he really fitted in. But, you know, that was all. Okay. So this, I write quite a bit about that period. And there were a number of people in that building that meant quite a lot. So I mentioned Schnoz Silver, Joe Silver, huge nose. And they called him Joe the Schnoz. So it was, Jock.
Like a mafia.
It was Jock. Well, they do. You read that part. Of the part in Yeovil at that time, and where I grow up, this is like the Jews of Brooklyn or the Bronx. Mm-hmm. So they've escaped from this dreadful Tsarist oppression where there have been pogroms and dreadful poverty. And under the control, and I'm not getting at the religion now, but, you know, we're talking about medieval conditions. And this is where, if you're in the Jewish shtetl, as the name is the village, and it can be urbanized and fairly urban, etc., where most come from. It's absolutely dirt poor. And, you know, the toilets out in the back and these kind of things that... They had the most miserable lives. So they were leaving because of persecution and for the gold in the streets, you know, Joburg, mainly once you get to America, etc. But anyway, I describe some of these people, and the ones I choose at the poker table are relevant because of the type of personality, and in a sense, I also mix personalities. To bring out what? You see, a memoir is not strict history. You're not writing the history. The readers need to know that. You need to convey that to the reader. Because how can you, with your memory, you can't remember everything as though you had the journal. So I make that point in the preface.
Which is where your title comes from.
Yes, so the title, Catching Murmurs, exactly where it comes from.
Right.
Catching Murmurs. I use this neighbour of mine who really was a close friend, Ivor, and his father was Sam, and you know, no one liked him, and he's six fingers Sam, because this guy had six fingers on each hand, and he played poker, and I'd watched him fascinated, especially since whenever he could, he was very meticulous, and so he would be cleaning, filing nails, and he'd give the pinkies the extra thing. He was an incredibly selfish guy, as opposed to the other guys at the table, and especially my grandfather, who used to take the piss out of Sam, you know, on Sam, and they were great rivals at the races and on the card table.
Very big endorsement.
So, very much. So, it's bringing this up, this is where you start, you give the names, and it's Sam and my grandfather and one or two others. And then the one child, I had many, which is Ivor, who I went to school with, and you know, throughout my life, although I didn't see him for a long time. But this is an example of what you strive, what you choose. It's very much that. And that's where I feel that when you read a lot of the struggle memoirs now, and it's very important, I'm not saying Charles isn't, and it's very engrossing as well.
It's very dry, Charles.
But when you've got to wade through most of these books through absolute photo album, you know, of this tribal family, and that obviously slows down the narrative, the important aspects that emerge from Charles's book. You know, why did the ANC seek an armed change? How did the people like Charles and others, he was a journalist in the Eastern Cape, and he was doing quite well, what motivated him as a black African to become involved? What was his background like? You know, this aspect, and then the politics, how did the politics develop? So the guys who then deal with the politics, as say a historian would, where you're giving it absolute, it's got to be absolutely accurate, the meeting and when it took place, who's there, who was elected, the Secretary General, and you know, you're not even talking about the ANC nationally, you're talking about a little township outside Port Elizabeth, and you're filling the pages that way. Most readers, unless you belong to the tribe, in other words, in this case, the ANC and the Liberation Movement, you're looking and you're reading. Oh, I know this guy, I know this guy. But it's not going to reach out further.
You know, I got the book on the Thursday, and yeah. I had to interview him on the Saturday.
Oh.
And I was really grateful when he came here that he actually just stood and talked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, I was, there's 20 million people in the book.
Sure.
But tell us, my friend Candy used to teach at the Other Boys, and she was there for about 25 years, and the kids wouldn't listen. She would twist their ears back.
Oh, yeah.
I was actually in a class the one day, and I said, you can't do that. I still can. I'm getting away with it. But you had a fabulous experience at CARES with your headmaster.
Well, you see, those days, for anybody, and I might be older than most here, but maybe all here. Yeah.
No, my mother, Aunt Rancy, sorry.
Where's your mother?
Wave, Mom.
Oh, then you are. Hi. No, I didn't see you. You're hidden behind everybody. I bow to you. We all know, I could see, you know, whoever's here, you know what school was like. And it was getting wrapped over the knuckles of the ruler and getting your ear pulled. If you're a boy, and it happened to me quite often, getting an incredible, as we say in South Africa, and I love the term, a clap on the back of the head. And then far worse. And I go into this aspect of corporal punishment because when you go to high school, it's absolutely so dreadful. And I go through that torment and that torture at the hands of a headmaster at King Edward. So I'm there from 1951 to 56. And this guy's name was St. John B. Nech, pronounced like St. John B. Nech. St. John B. Nech. And you know, he looked like a medieval monk. I learned that from my mother, how the parents, if she had a friend whose boy was at the school, and they had to take an early holiday for some family reason of illness or something, and she had to go to the head and ask if the boy could leave school like a week before the end of term. And she had worked herself up, speaking to my mother, into such a state of nervousness. She'd never spoken to him, but when you laid eyes on him, you froze, absolutely froze. And she spoke to my mother about needing Valium and coming there. And then when she finally got into his office and he was so austere, she just broke down and she was trembling and she couldn't speak. And that touched him amazingly, because he had that Mrs. Cummins nodding and went, "I come down to have some water, now what is it?" And he immediately gave in. He went, "Yeah, they do need a holiday." But this guy, because I come from Yodel and I'm just a bloody mischievous, sometimes idiot, getting up to pranks, etc. The first time I got caned by the boss, I was so utterly stupid. But I was always the smallest in the class, believe it or not, and very scraggly. Maybe that's why I kind of, you know, made up
the list
of being the mischievousness and the wise guy, etc. And we had a male secretary of the school who used to do the rounds of the register. And as one day, we hadn't realized that they had employed a young woman, who must have been like 18, 19, to assist him. And suddenly we're in the class, and there's the slip of a girl. She's 19, maybe even 20. One of these really, really young and youthful looking, and she comes in with the register, and some idiot in the class emits a wolf whistle.
Some idiot.
The teachers have a right to cane you, but if it's so serious, whistling, they send you to the boss, and you go off to the boss. And this guy gave me 3 cuts. I'd never been beaten like that. It was so horrendous, he almost passed out. I reckon, and I say in this book, that I think he was a paedophile. The way he would grasp you and push you over and lift up your jacket, stuff like that.
Was that your word whistle, and then you end up paying for somebody else because you're always suspecting it?
The idiot sitting here.
Okay. I thought maybe because he had a reputation, you know.
The teacher wasn't sure, and he blamed you. But I point out in the book, you know, I'm dealing there, that sort of chapter, and a bit of a case, these upper class schools, though it's a government school. The authoritarianism, the corporal punishment of those days, chauvinism. Incidentally, when you read about what's just happened at Pretoria Boys High and the dereliction of duty from the head down to the teachers, you kind of think, God, has it really changed that mentality? And what my book shows, you see, without me being didactic, which is why I go into my youth, and Yeovil Boys, and then into KISS, I bring out why we sometimes behave in such an idiotic way, why we were such little male chauvinists, so that when you looked at girls, there were just 2 types, and they were the ones who were determined to be virgins when they married, and then the ones who you could have a good time with, you know, when they were 16 or so.
collected tickies.
Pardon?
And collected tickies.
You know, all that stuff that I referred to there. But the corporal punishment and the macho and the aggression and the street fights, it's there, I say this in the book, from the gold mine days of Joburg, the new mining camp of Joburg, and the authoritarianism and the bare knuckles, the kind of society that was being created. Obviously, the rule over blacks and the absence of justice. And I leave it to the reader to see how this transmits through to the school system and then how the teachers behave. So instead of what they should have done with a young idiot, and I feel so embarrassed to this day at my behavior, quite frankly, without any thought how embarrassed this young girl would be. Can you imagine? It's her first day in a boys' school and some kid whistles at her. I didn't think of her and how hurt she might have been, embarrassed.
Or flattered.
Nobody, neither my teacher, or when I go to the bleeding headmaster, none of them say, you know, don't you realise how insensitive you are? Not at all. They don't say anything. You know, I go to him, I have to say, sir, I've been sent here because I was with this new secretary. What? Just bend down. And that's it. Bang, bang, bang. It's absolutely horrendous strokes. So you go back home and you find that there's blood in your underpants and so on. You make sure that your mother's not going to see you for 6 weeks. Because there's the red welts which go purple and black, etc. And I go on there. Then the rebel in me, you react and you hate these guys. And I then fought them at school. A lot of kids just go passive and go into their shells and they harmed in other ways, isn't that so? And then there's those who getting the beating, all they want to do is inflict punishment on others when they get bigger and so on. You know, that's the nature of catching the tadpole. So why catching the tadpole?
Yeah, why catching the tadpole?
So, sorry, I've just got a little bit of a snuffle here. My grandmother, who I absolutely adored, and her daughter, my mother, who I absolutely adored. So throughout my life, I fall in love with women. I love women. Now, I'm not talking about the chauvinistic way. I just had such lovely experience from the woman who brought me up, my wife and Nina, also with the slippers. Anyway, the tadpoles is this little kid goes on these family picnics, and my grandmother is always with me, and it starts off with us exploring and looking at the little garden pools and ponds and, you know, on the picnics in the countryside, and I see these tiny little black blobs with these big heads and the swishy tails, and they're the tadpoles, and I try to catch them with my little pudgy hands, and obviously I can't. And she, I think they had brought a net along for this very reason. So she shows me how to scoop them up, take them home in the jam jar, hoping they're going to see them grow into frogs, which was something that would absolutely space me out. What, these things become frogs, come at me. Which is also a metaphor here for growing up and what you become. Because, of course, frogs are actually knowable creatures. And they the canary in the cage as well for the environment and so on. So there's this catching of the tadpoles. When my publisher, after the three previous books from Sharpville right through to today have been published, Bridget MP says to me 2 years ago, Ronnie, you know what? You've written three books now from Sharpville through your whole period in government, struggle in government, and then about your late wife and her role in the struggle. So although it's a memoir, it's more a story about this lady who was very courageous. And then about Jacob Zuma from a memoir point of view. And so Bridget MP says to me, you must go back and you must tell people in South Africa, how is it that a young white kid from a modest home but with privilege gives it all up and is crazy, prepared to do the crazy things as a small minority of whites did. So, you know, I'm not alone, it's not just me. But it's a very tiny minority. You know the names, Helen Joseph, Ruth First, Rusty Bernstein, Joan Slovin, etc. But a couple of hundred people through history, that's all. How is it? What makes you give all of that up? Which is what young black people always ask. How did you do it? What did you get out of it? And I think it was a big salary or something. So the point she was making was, you've got to explain to people, and that's not just born frees, the people who are here now and around the country of all backgrounds, what was it that made people like this tick, prepared, to face danger and sacrifice, etc. So there I was beginning now to look into the deep, dark recesses of my mind, the pools within my mind, to catch the memories as with the tadpoles. And this was
slipping out of your grasp.
And it was like that. You know, you get a vague memory of something, either the poker table, Six Finger Sam, or whatever, the argument with my grandfather, etc. Stuff like whistling at the teacher coming, at the young lady. And you get a little bit of that. That was, why was I came? Why did I get sent to the boss, the head, that day? And then coming into view, out of the ripples and the pools, will be this young girl coming in with the registry book. So it's grasping at those memories and then turning it into a narrative, which let me immediately say, it can't be exactly what happened in that classroom, can it? It can't be. I didn't have a recording machine. I didn't have a camera. It's in my mind. But memory's fallible. So what's the point of a memoir where you're not writing when you come to read Churchill on the Second World War, Trotsky on the Russian Revolution, whatever it might be, Alan Payton, this, that, and the other, professor this, professor that, where they've got to go trawl through diaries and film and recordings and interviews and attempt to explain the history exactly. So a memoir is not that. And in a memoir, I make sure in the preface to say, I'm not writing history. I'm not doing what Van Honselen, is a great historian. You know the name Van Honselen, who's done all these histories, really, about the early, the Advantis Road, the gold mines, etc., etc. They go into the detail to make sure that the history is as accurate as can be. But a memoir is your impressions. And what the reader is served there, you know Yeovil, others don't. It can't be exactly like Yeovil was, and other people writing about it will see it differently. So you've got to believe there's got to be a credibility about the person writing. The moment you see, now this is a load of rubbish, this can't have happened or whatever, this way, that way, that's incorrect, you're going to drop the book. You've got to build up that credibility. They've got to feel that the reader can trust one, and for yourself, because in the first place you write for yourself as well. What was Ivan like? What was Sam like? What was my grandfather like? Which I had much more information about, and its impressions. So when I wrote about Dar es Salaam in the other book, and Victoria said this is very useful, and Macmillan about Zambia, they're not going to write, use that. And they historians, the book Macmillan's written about the ANC years is an academic's history of the ANC in Lusaka and in Zambia. But he's able to quote from an ANC member who was living there that time and who saw Lusatu in the following way. And when he visits, as I write about, going into Tambo's office and describe Tambo, etc. This is a view of Ronnie Casserole. So this is where the memoir is different from history and academic things, and in a sense, from autobiography. Because what you do expect from autobiography, it's where the memoir gives you free array. It's rather easy because it's so much about the emotion, the impressions, the reflection. The very word memoir is reflection, you see, a remembrance, etc., from the French. An autobiography has to go through from start to finish of a life and give the detail, and very often you need the letters, you need the journal, etc. Without that, it's impossible. But this, of course, is a long book, and so are the others. You read a person's autobiography or biography about the person, or a memoir, if there's something interesting about the person, or you don't want to read. You know, you said Zamazins or Flippers. So I know there's Zamazins, they would never read Ronnie Casserole, but there are others who are interested. What made this guy tick? And that's why, I know we won't go there.
You can go there if you want, but
I have in mind, when I write there, my family members who are in Israel and who I've had ups and downs with, in the end it's become really blossomed well, because in the past they were very jittery about me and why did I say this, that and the other. But I write for them as well, to understand how somebody can have particular views. So let's, okay, get away from that. Let's take Afrikaners. So the Afrikaners initially thought, maybe all whites, but I'm taking them specifically, that the blacks would murder them, we'd go a bit easier, blacks would go a bit easier on Jews and on English speakers, etc. And of course the communists would hate their guts. But they actually discover that we're not like that. There's some people we might be. And I'm so keen to be able to get across to that group of people. And I don't have that hatred. And in fact, when I talk about teachers who helped to change me, I talk about Darby White, who's a crazy Scotsman who was our physical training instructor, Teddy Gordon, who obviously is the Jewish guy who teaches us history, and then Bootsy van der Riet, who came to us. But when Bootsy came to you, he was laughing and you were laughing. And it was like the ritual. And he was just this great guy who, what you saw, you got. And there would be a guy who spoke to you in such a way that you learned from him. So, you know, these are the characters. I spoke to some of my former KISS friends, old boys, and quite a few of them are absolutely amazed at the way I depict the head, St. John B. Nitch, because they never got caned by him. So I'm saying, well, you being in that study with me, and there are guys who agree with me. So, you know, there's one thing that everybody says, absolute lies, this, that, and the other. They're sufficient people. I write about the murder of Bubble Schroeder, which was the celebrated case in 1949 of this young Afrikaans playgirl who gets picked up, and she's always at the Turfontein races by three Jewish guys who live out at Ilova. And
One wife still does.
Of those three guys, Liebman, Bolchik, and Polanski. So this guy's contacted me now. One of the accused, the three of them were accused because they partied with her that night. And then they squabbled and she was dropped off in Dunkeld. In those days, it was just plantations around from Ilova and so on. And her body was found strangled the next day. So the three guys who had parted with her were arrested. And they were found not guilty. No one was ever discovered. But I deal with that aspect because I then, as a 12-year-old, I shared a room with Jaime Liebner, who was number one accused. And we were down in Duesenberg. I was there with my parents. He was there as a guest of a hotel owners. He'd been just released from prison. So I got to know him. But I never saw him again until the other day. He phoned the publisher to say he wants to see me because he's going to write his memoir and he wants to talk to me about it.
Riley Azanopoulos wrote Bubbles. She wrote a book about Bubbles. I've actually got it on my shelf. I'll show you.
Oh, yeah.
She did write it. And Mrs. Bilchick is going strong.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In fact, she owns a piece of art.
Is that so?
With her Zinskis and her.
So is this one of yours?
No, it's not. I just don't know where to put that one. Thank you. Ronnie, have you got glasses here?
You read, not me.
I must read.
Yeah, do you want to read? You
what part?
No. If is there a part you want to read?
No, I don't know. What would you like me to read? The War Against the Flies?
No. I'm just trying to think, Janine. You remember we gave extracts. So why don't you go ahead? I haven't got glasses, but Anina, have you got yours?
After this, there will be dessert and coffee for anybody who wants.
Yeah, so we should go ahead because we've gone through. See, it's not just the book about a 6-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a schoolboy. Quite a lot of the book is after school. I'm looking for what's the meaning of life, actually. And I work for a lawyer and then for a film studio, which is how I then get to work for Lieber Brothers from the Vision. And I got very involved with the Hillbrow Bohemian set, which was full of such colour and flamboyance. At that time, it was, you know, like Yeovil had a specific meaning, and Hillbrow as well. But we go through the Hillbrow period, and then I go to Cape Town following one of these Hillbrow bohemians who I was falling in love with, and she's run away to Cape Town, so I follow her, and there's all that romance and bohemian kind of lifestyle, and that then leads to me crossing the colour bar line, because I got very involved in existentialism. As, you know, what is life about? I started reading this philosophy, various kinds, so it led me to Marxism. But I was taken up with Jean-Paul Sartre and existentialism, which was the going thing at the time. People posing as, like I probably did, as existentialist. Artists and some genuine people, writers and artists in Hillbrow, really very genuine. A lot of the lesbian and gay community. So because I was unconventional, this background had led me to not see people in stereotypical ways. And I had friends also coming out of the Jewish community, which can be very enclosed. I started breaking away from that, which is where the anti-Zionism comes in. Because if I can say this, in the lessons I learned from my mother, the turning points of my life from her seeing a black man being beaten in Joburg, I might read that. That's what I might read. And my mother said to me that our Jewish religion teaches us to respect everybody, Ronald. And you must be kind, you must respect people, and you must treat others as you would wish them to treat you. That's Judaism. That's us Jews. And absolutely, yeah. But you see, when you then expand your universe, I start discovering that actually, the Christians believe that, and then the Muslims believe that, and that way of looking really helped me. So I'm not saying that I've got family members, including here, who've remained devout, remain in the community and hardly have friends outside. And they socialize within the community. You know, I'm one of these, they would say, you know, this is cosmopolitan, you know, you leave your tribe. Zuma has that attitude. He'd say to, I got friendly with him, you know, Ronnie, I don't understand. You never married a Jewish woman. You should have married a Jewish woman. I married a young Irish woman, a bohemian, and that was just a crazy marriage which ended in a divorce. Then I married a woman who was Scots Presbyterian, but likely atheist, growing up in Durban. And it's all here and in the various memoirs. And that was a 48-year marriage. So I'm not a philanderer. You know, I had a marriage of 48 years. And after she died, within some years, I met up with Amina. So, you know, this is why I'm saying I see great benefit in having a relationship with good women. But there's that kind of attitude. You see, if you're Jewish and you marry outside, it's like, you know, you're excommunicated. It's not all Jews. And there's Zulus who are like this. You know, Jews aren't just some strange species which the kind of anti-Semitism has created. Because you find this aspect where, you know, in some of the Scots nationalists or the Irish, the Zulus here, any of the groups around the country, they won't intermarry. But it brings me then to the first turning point in my life. Okay, and that is in 1946. I was going to read from Sharpeville, which is the final key turning point. The first is the one I'm going to read now. The second is my history teacher at King Edward's and what happens there. And then the third is Sharpeville and how I then decide that existentialism, which is about individual freedom, is something that's too narrow. That if you want to stand up for humanity, you've got to be involved actively with others. And, you know, that's the Marxian approach. That's how I then developed into a Marxist. But this initial one, I'm 7 going 8. My grandmother is dying of cancer. She's been languishing in my bedroom in a small flat in the Oval. And my mother's devoted to her. And I'm farmed out to stay with the relatives from time to time. I've got a sister, it's just the two of us, so she goes elsewhere. And my mother takes me downtown. So I get back into the geography of going to Rocky Street, the B2 tram, going through Hillbrow, and then down Elof, to Elof Street, whatever. And we get off in Rissick Street. So if you can just give me a moment to find this. You see, you caught me by surprise.
Sorry. Keeping you on your toes.
Okay, I just said, I hope you, I'm not going to be too long. Okay, I think I've got it now. Okay. Okay, so this is Johannesburg, 1946. I found out the exact date in an interesting way, which I didn't remember. So I'm swimming and swimming, which I this is the way I was writing this book, reminiscing in a swimming pool. Every day I swim. And it's therapy. I swim for slowly and for a long time, and I find that wonderful to catch tadpoles, thinking and reminiscing. So, my pulse beat accelerates stroke after stroke through the water as I relive the horror that gave rise to my mother's words of wisdom that followed the incident. And I sense that I'm tapping that particular tadpole. It started on the day in 1946 when she took me for a treat to the movies in downtown Johannesburg Perhaps it's a break from being stuck at home, caring for Granny Clara. Fancy Art Deco cinema houses they were. We used the word bioscope in those days. Metro, 20th Century Fox, the Plaza, Empire, Coliseum, and His Majesty's. We would catch the B2 tram from Rocky Street. I'm just skipping a few descriptive things. And arriving at the Rissick Street post office. One moment I was anticipating the joy of a Hollywood film with ice cream. The next, all hell broke loose. My mother yanked my arm to get us out of the way of a bunch of cursing white hooligans furiously swinging punches at a man who was reeling under the blows. The man wore a smart jacket and slacks and a pair of fashionable black and white shoes. These I noticed before he sank into the gutter, blood streaming from his head. I remember the flash of a bronze knuckle duster striking his temple with a sickening crunch while kicks and blows thudded into his body. The thugs' faces were ugly and vicious, filled with primitive hate. White pedestrians scattered. I noted older boys from the Yeovil neighborhood, tough guys I looked up to, scurrying out of the way like rabbits. A smartly dressed woman shouted, "Stop! Stop! You're killing him!" And they jeered at her, Kaffir-loving bitch, as they slunk away after stamping the man's fine hat flat and kicking it into the gutter. What had this person done to merit such a beating? We heard a guy muttering, "That native ought to have got out of their way. He was taking up the pavement. This is a white man's town. That native boy must know his place. How dare he think he can become a white man by changing from animal skins into Western clothing?" By the time my mother and I turned the corner, I was sobbing. "Oh, Ma, let's go home. I don't want to go to the bio anymore." My mother must have persisted, probably to get both her mind and mine off the nightmare, and we went anyway. I think the movie was Road to Rio, featuring Bob Hope and Bing Crosby with the Andrews sisters, so it appealed to us both. A couple of things from that incident. I'm aware of what had happened, the Holocaust in Europe under the Nazis, because we'd seen this even as 5 and 6 and 7 year old kids. We'd go up to the local bug house to the Saturday matinee for kids' cartoons and movies, cowboys and so on. But the idiots, see, I'm not the only one, would leave the movie tone news on, bringing the world to the world, and in it you would see these pictures of the war, the goose-stepping Nazis, and by about 1945, 46, the concentration camps and the inmates. We also would hear, in that period of my growing up, the relatives, the parents, talking in hushed whispers, which of course the kids would catch, about what's happening. So you had this knowledge, you had this imagery. And I said to my mother, after a week, which was a very restless week for me, not sleeping well, for the first time peeing in my bed one night and so on, disturbed. And they were trying to counsel me. And I said to her, "Is the way that man was being treated the way us Jews were treated in Nazi Germany?" And this lovely woman who left school to go and work when she was 16, she thought, I can see her face to this day, his eyes looking, and she was searching for the words. We had to choose the correct words for this 7-year-old. And she said, "Well, Ronald, it's not quite like that, because you already know what is happening to the Jews in Europe. the concentration camps, the death camps, and the gas chambers. So we don't have that in South Africa, but it starts like that when people get beaten up because of the color of their skin or their religion. And if nothing is done to stop it, it just gets worse and worse, which is why we must be kind to people, we must respect people. And then, of course, I told you already about, you know, what Judaism is, etc., etc. And that was the first real turning point in my life. And it gave me an empathy with whatever the color, but in the first place, obviously, for the black people you saw who were so poor and were being mistreated, even in the yokel streets, even in my relatives' kitchens and the neighbors' kitchens. My parents were fortunately kinder and respected people. And that's where you write a book like this with a memory like that. This is a therapeutic aspect for me. But I'm wanting to give people insights, and you can make of it what you will. But I expect that, in parts, a contribution to humanizing us. And for a reader, this is what a memoir should do. You can't, you might not be Jewish, it's a minority, but whatever you are, to be able to put yourself in a person's shoes or in that neighborhood and so on, and think yourselves about your own lives. And hopefully a good memoir can impart something to civilize, to create greater understanding and so on. So I might, if we're coming more
to this, I'm just about to open this.
Yes, just to say that in closing, because I always like to encourage people to write, that there's a wonderful writer and psychologist in America called Julie Gurner, G-U-R-N-E-R, and you can check her on Google, and there's lots of interesting things about writing and memory and so on. And she says that if you've reached the age of 18, you've got enough material to write about for the rest of your lives. And then on memory, there's a man, again he's American, called Bill Briggs, B-R-I-G-G-S. And he is a writer and a motivationalist. And he's very interested in psychology of the mind and memory. And he talks about first memories. And this is like a challenge to you all. What you can remember, your very first memory. So, you know, we go through life and you forget about your childhood, etc. I had to start thinking back, and then you become infatuated with it. And you've got to, consider when you think, what do you think is your first memory, and how far back can you go? And if you Google memory and you get into the most fascinating debate amongst basically clinical psychiatrists and psychologists and writers, Virginia Woolf is full of this, that she's fascinated with memory and writing about memory. It's a fascinating experience. And Bill Briggs quotes a leading psychoanalyst in America who's steeped in the study of memory. And this woman claims that her first memory was when she was 2 years old. And that creates a big debate, because a lot of people feel that you can only really remember once you start speaking. You see, it's when you think back, it's really when you've got language which reinforces memory. Without language, it's very difficult. You might grasp something, which this woman does before she can speak. And obviously, she's still baby talk. But she says her first memory was the image of a horse at her window. And in her bedroom window, the family had moved from town to country. and that when she woke up the very first morning, there was a horse at the window, she would check with her parents that she was two. But the point is she remembering?
Somebody's
or is, the, is her mother saying to her, oh, Julie, do you remember when we came here, the reason why you love horses, and I always used to say so, the reason why you like riding ponies, it's the very first time you woke up in this house or the farmhouse, you saw the horse at the window. So that gets imprinted. Okay. It's fascinating stuff. And, you know, with me here, that's why I said, look, this description of the man being beaten, in my mind, I can see these three, four, but I've lost the number, could have been five. It was definitely a group, and they were short, and they must have been like 19, 20, and it was definitely outside, I don't mention it here, a cinema, a bioscope, tea room buyer, which were places in those days in town where riffraff hung out all day, you know, eating drugs or doing deals. And they were never allowed to go into a tea room buyer. And they were hanging around the tea room buyer. And I think that he was wearing black and white jammies, but maybe he wasn't. The thing is that he was sartorially very elegant, which is why they couldn't bear him. And I had that impression. But was he wearing black and white shoes? That might have been superimposed in my memory by the early Zoot form of dress of Africans. But does it matter? You see, it doesn't matter. And this is the thing about the memoir. As long as I'm trying to be truthful and that we can read it together and you can feel, yeah, well, this is the times. And what it conjures up, what I'm wanting to conjure up, is my memory, the feeling, the texture of the moment, the horror, and the fact that this was a black man unusually dressed. In terms of these white thugs were dreadfully dressed, you know, by comparison, which is why they obviously turned on him. But just the last point, you know how I discovered that we were most likely going to see Dean Crosby, Bob Hope in Rotorua with the Andrew sisters? Because I had in my mind that we went to see a Bob Hope and Crosby film. And my mother loved the Andrew sisters. So I Googled the films, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, 1946. I wasn't sure it was 1946, but I thought it must be around there. And boom, there you've got the movie that comes out in 1946. So Google is fantastic to be able to just check and verify. And without Google, you know what it would have cost me, like weeks going to, well, maybe not weeks, but going to a library, finding a biography of Bob Hope, and discovering when his films were made. You know. So the Google, you know, it took me a minute, 2 minutes, and I had it. Thank you.
Are there any questions, Veronica? Bill? Mark? You heard it?
May I ask some questions? I'd like to ask a little bit about the early days of your time in the ANC. The sort of rough times, because I think you spoke about the recreation of, or the rebuilding of the ANC. I have two kinds of things I'd like to ask. The one is, how important was Nelson Mandela as a figure that stands up against the system? And how was Verwoerd? Was he like a nightmare kind of a person who's busy just crushing things and smashing things down? How did you guys see those two people?
So I'm going to start with Verwoerd. And then I come to Mandela, who I actually knew. So in those days, there was no television, and you had South African, you know, Movietone News, South African one, in the cinemas, and that was the only time you might see Jan Smuts or Verwoerd, or unless you went to the rugby Springboks and so on. And you kind of tried to gauge what they were like fleetingly from a newsreel. Otherwise, it was photographs in the newspaper. And then it depended on how people spoke. So the English-speaking press had a campaign going at the stage leading to David Pratt shooting Verwoerd at the Rand show. And my father worked for David Pratt's family, by the way.
Oh, they wow.
The downtown Dorfinty sweet factory. And the Pratts were very nice people. My father told me, you know, when all this happened, the only family in the Magaliesberg with a huge farm, where they farmed, and that's where David Pratt was. His brother, Stuart, was my father's boss at Crispy's Candy. And my father told us that the Pratts allowed anybody of any race to picnic on their farmlands. So non-white people who had scant place to go when they wanted to picnic, they all used to home in on their farm. But why did Pratt, who was not very political except English speaker, so, you know, the apartheid aspect, they might have voted United Party, not very, very militant or anything, but Verwoerd was so identified with what was going wrong in the country and with apartheid as the architect that the English-speaking press were running a campaign, Verwoerd must go, and it was almost daily in the Sunday papers, banner headlines, Verwoerd must go, you know. And this is what got through to David Pratt, clearly turned his mind in that kind of climate. It's only in latter years that with Google and so on, you can actually check Verwoerd and his speeches at the time and interviews with him. And I'd heard this about Verwoerd, that he was an avuncular character. And he would discuss apartheid policy in very reasonable ways. And we're not against the black man, but we're different. The races are different. We don't want to take advantage of people. And therefore, apartheid is simply to keep people in their own categories so that there's peace and progress. And the black person, the Khoza in his category, and the Zulu in his, and the coloured in theirs, they must have their own space, because God did not want people to mix. This is what causes trouble. And he literally speaks this way. It's like a mad professor who's totally carried away with an absolute evil doctrine, the result of which is this incredible suffering of people. And in those days, one didn't see this aspect of Verwoerd. And it doesn't mean he wasn't evil, but he was just known as this is the architect of apartheid and totally hated, hated and loathed, except by those who, in their view, we must keep totally apart. Now, this doesn't go against Jews having their own particular community, or Irish, or 1820 settlers, or, you know, or the Scots, or whatever. But it's where you come together for your own particular culture without denying others and equality and justice and so on. And the whole apartheid thing puts into actual legal effect the group areas of the dispossession of land, you know, that whole gory detail. So he was an absolutely horrendous character who was responsible. But in personality terms, there were far worse guys who were absolutely guttural and vicious, whereas Favut never raised his voice. He never screamed and shouted and banged tables and threatened people. But, you know, he was obviously a guy that people would have, if they knew him, have a bit of second doubt. And, you know, but he's a very kindly, uncle-y, avuncular figure. Nelson Mandela, by the time I become aware of him, is the 1959, the treason trial, which is 56, and I'm kind of in the trick. So one's aware that, you know, without any personal knowledge or detail about people like Chief Albert Luthuli, about Mandela and the others, and you don't have any idea of what they actually stand for, that they are standing for a non-racist South Africa in which we'll live together and in a democracy and so on. The whites don't have any knowledge of that. Unless you have a teacher like Teddy Gordon who gives me or directs me to read a book by Trevor Huddleston, North for Your Comfort, which is a brilliant book about what apartheid is. So, you know, when you see photos of a Mandela or even a Chief Luthuli or a Trevor Huddleston, you think that these guys are, if they're black, are like racist and wanting, like people would think today to some degree, you know, through the years, that the word terrorism wasn't in the vocabulary at that time. But, you know, these are the leaders of the natives who will kill all of us whites. And they're absolutely far from that. By the time I become politically aware and join, I then have recourse to speeches, pamphlets, even some books were available about the ANC and about Mandela or Luthuli, and you then become really very, very impressed. When you start actually meeting these people, then you are blown away, because these are people with incredible intellect. And, you know, you've grown up as a white, and no matter how liberal you might be, the blacks you know are people in menial service who don't have a good English. And here you suddenly meeting with black guys who have an English language and vocabulary far better than one's own, and who are extremely kind people, serious, discuss things, give their time, if there's the opportunity to answer a question, because we would then meet as a small group of whites who I was attracted to, these house meetings, like a meeting like this, but it would be illegal, so we couldn't all leave our cars the way we have today, and yet it would be at night, and you'd come in, and it wouldn't be as big as this, but maybe a dozen people, and there would be somebody like a Mandela who's there to actually tell this group who are seriously interested what does the ANC stand for. So I met Mandela a little later. I'd met a few others beforehand who were leaders, and then I met Mandela when I joined Umkhonto weSizwe, and he came to meet the command group in Durban to brief us and to guide us and to discuss MK. And I write about that in my first memoir, which is Armed and Dangerous.
Which I have.
So, you know, you can try and find that.
Yeah.
But very, very impressive. And that's why, sorry, that's why you've had such respect accorded, not to justice. Mandela's not the flesh in the pan. This Chief Albert John Luthuli, I would rate the most impressive, more than Mandela.
Oh, wow.
You've heard the name. he was the president of the ANC, and I think they killed him in about 1966. And there's a case that his family are bringing now, because he was a very large, wonderful guy, a bit like Paul Robeson, if anyone knows it, great African-American singer. And he was a great singer. I was in meetings with Luthuli down in the sugarcane fields of Natal, usually at an Indian farm. And there'd be about 50, 60 people from around South Africa. Mandela was out of the country at that time. And Luthuli was like Martin Luther King, even more imposing, because Luthuli was like, you know, a Muhammad Ali. He, you know, that, well, Mandela as well, you know, this big build, but he had more girth to him. And a really kind, lovely, he was a very Christian man. Without, you know, not a Desmond Tutu type, but he was very Christian and absolutely incredible man. So it was said that a railway locomotive knocked him down near his home in Grytville, where he was restricted, banished to. And there's very big doubt about whether he wasn't pushed into that train.
Assassination, maybe.
Sorry,
going back to your schoolboy days.
Yes.
You wrote about being at school with Gary Player.
Yes.
And you wrote about him later. Is there anything else you can tell us about Gary Player and your contact with him over that period?
So at school, he wasn't, I didn't note him much. He didn't seem to play the ongoing sports because he was spending all his time at Observatory Golf Course every minute. And came to my attention, and I write about it in Buti van der Rich's class. So Buti's teaching us, we're 14-year-olds, and there's a knock on the door, and Buti looks and he sees there's something important. He says, "Hey, kiddos, makhabeki. If I met Iman Pra," and goes and is out for 20 minutes. Yeah, we're very happy to study or whatever. Then he comes back in and he's looking so concerned. He says, "Hey, Iman Kevels, I must tell you something. You must finish your matric. If you don't finish matric, you're not going to get on in this world." He says, "There's Gary. You know Gary Player. He's leaving school before he's finishing matric. He says he's leaving to go and play golf. What kind of a future do you think he's got?" And it happened. A lot of people think it's apocryphal. And you find a lot of kiss boys, and you know, there was that story. And they tell you, and I say, "Listen, I was in the class." So in the exile years, I grew to loathe Gary Player. Because whenever we saw or heard about him, and this now is, we had access to TV, whether in Europe or parts of Africa. And there's Gary Player, and playing with J.B. Foster, and there he is representing South Africa. Okay, we didn't boycott an individual, it was usually the team, South Africa. But Gary Player was very specific and special because he boasted about being an ambassador for South Africa, and it's a lovely country, and everything's peaceful, etc. So he was one of the hated ones. Next time I saw him is at the inauguration of Mandela. And at that inauguration, through Mandela's generosity, he made sure that quite a number of the old establishment were invited, not just the rogues and communists and terrorists and naughty boys like me. And so they were around, and there's Gary Player. And lo and behold, I mean, I would have gone up to speak to him anyway, but he comes to me. This is this world-famous sportsman. He was so on his own there, and clearly he was feeling isolated. And he sees me, and he comes over, shake my hand. He's running casual. He said, "Oh, we've heard so much about you. All these kids boys used to gossip, you know, it's terrible of running." And he says, "The one thing I know about you, you had the kindest mother in the Oval."
I'm going to call it there.
And you know why? Because when I went to school, apart from my mother telling me before I went to the Oval, "Ronald, when the Christian boys tell you that the Jews killed Jesus, just tell them it wasn't the Jews, it was the Romans that had sex. The Romans, you, the Romans. I never had to, was it confronted that way. When I go to Kess, so she packs me the lunch and she puts in the extra sandwiches for the boarders. So that's I'd be accepted by everybody. But what I discovered from Gary and another guy who I've met since is that my mother used to come to these guys beyond my ken, out of the streets of
And I will make sure dessert is out in a sec, and then there's coffee and tea. So, by all means.
Very much for your attention.
There are so many things that Ronnie Kasrils mentioned in his talk that I thought I really need to go back over some of the points that he mentions, just to clarify it, especially for the people outside South Africa who don't know some of the details of what he's talking about. So I'm going to jump between several different points, various things that he spoke about during his talk. In his talk, you will hear that there was a lot of secrecy involved in being a communist, and that is because South Africa passed a law called the Suppression of Communism Act. Rhodesia had a similar thing. We did not allow communists to function in our countries, and I think that Americans will realize as time goes by that allowing communists to function inside America is a very, very bad thing. Because while those communists are sitting around, they're all working for the downfall of the whites of America. And all your racial problems, rest assured, are related to Jews and communists. So one of the things that Ronnie Kasrils talks about is he talks about the fact that when he was operating with these communists, that they had a secret name for him. He had like a covert name. And his covert name was the name of a black guy, Khumalo. So Khumalo was his secret name. And a lot of the stuff where he talks about secrecy, it's well worth studying that stuff. Because this is how these people snuck around and continued to work underground against the whites. And we ourselves nowadays are finding ourselves in the same situation, where we can't do our politics, even though officially we're supposed to be free, in reality we're not, and liberals and Jews are trying to stop us. So notice all the secret things they had to do for decades and decades. And so we should not be too upset about the fact that now it's our turn, but we can do much better than they can, with less resources as well. In their cases, they needed the resources of states across the world in order to even achieve tiny things. Whereas we in the white right are achieving tremendous things without any major funding from anybody at all. And our funding is cut in every conceivable way. These are problems that they did not have. The Soviet Union gave them billions of dollars, US dollars, worth of weaponry over the various decades. Another thing to note is that he talks about his time when he was in Durban in the Natal province. There are lots of Zulus there and there are lots of Indians there. Americans will know them as East Indians. Notice how he mentioned that Indian farm owners allowed the communists to come and hold meetings with the blacks on their farms. Indians. And if you look at the ANC, you will see that there are a lot of Indians who were communists in the ANC and related political organizations. Indians, beware of them, whites. Indians are backstabbing bastards. You cannot trust them, just like the Jews. Notice how Casserolles spent a lot of time living in London. And here is a guy from the South African Communist Party living in London, and he's totally safe. Totally safe in Jewish Britain. Britain allows communists to function. Britain, good old honest Britain, allows communists to function there safely. Britain even gave a place for Karl Marx, the Jew who founded communism, even gave him a place to stay after he'd been chased out of various places in Europe, after he had tried to create communist revolution in Europe. Britain allows all kinds of evil things, and Britain is no friend of South Africa. Jewish Britain has always been at odds with the whites of South Africa. Later we'll return to the topic of Britain and Jews working against South Africa, and you'll see some really shocking things. Notice also how he explains how they got free tickets and could fly from one place to another. It often was a winding journey between all sorts of different countries. When he talks about the socialist countries, he's talking about the communist countries, he's talking about the Warsaw Pact, etc., all the allies of the Soviet Union. And notice how he can manage to move from those socialist countries, eventually via normal airlines, to Britain. If you listen to him carefully, you'll also notice that he has a problem with Jacob Zuma, who is a Zulu. The ANC originally was a Khoza organization, the Khoza being a tribe from the Eastern Cape. Nelson Mandela is a Khoza. But the ANC had lots of fights with the Zulus. And then along came Jacob Zuma, who was a Zulu communist, and he got into the ANC. And that is how they managed to get all the blacks onto the same side. But you'll see that now there's a split between the Zuma communists of the ANC and the Ramaphosa communists of the ANC. It should be clear that this Jewish communist does not like Zuma ultimately. And the press and the liberals and the liberal Jews are all against Zuma. So that should show you that Zuma is not on the same page as them. That there is a split now, and that split inside the ANC is quite intense. And the two sides, while both making up the ANC, are battling against each other. So there is some hope that with time this will lead to more infighting among them. But I don't think that they look like they're going to split. It looks like no matter how much they fight with each other, they will keep their fight inside the ANC. They may even kill some of the people inside, but the ANC is their main structure. He talks about spending time in countries like Angola, which used to be Portuguese, which became communist. He talks about spending time in Tanzania, which also harbored communists. He was in Zambia. All these places were jumping off points for terrorists coming into South Africa and Rhodesia. He makes an interesting commentary about his time as the Minister of Intelligence. I found that very interesting. And he seems to indicate that there is even more corruption in the world of intelligence than anywhere else. Also, he talks about the fact that he's no longer part of the tribe. And by tribe, he's not referring to the Jews. He's meaning the family, if you could call it that, of the ANC and the communists. that he's now out of that tribe. And he's talking about political figures who said to him he must stay inside. So him moving out of that political arena so that he can criticize it, that is very interesting. There is something going on. Rest assured, the Jew is busy Jewing. When he talks about his time in Zambia, Zambia was a country that was between Rhodesia and Angola. And Zambia is a country from which lots of trouble came for the whites. All the main political, violent communist organizations that attacked whites had a good foothold inside Zambia. All the Rhodesian ones were there. Even the ANC was there. Even some that fought against the Portuguese were there. It is quite amazing that the whites were not in a position to declare war on Zambia. The more I look back on the events that took place in Zambia and the harm it brought to the whites, the more I wonder why whites didn't just wipe out Zambia. But as it was, the whites were already in deep trouble and struggling with international sanctions. So invading a black country would probably have been too much, and maybe the Jews would have gotten the whole world up against us and been bombing us if we'd done that. But when I look at the activities that took place in Zambia, it's absolutely hideous what they got away with. So when he talks about being in Zambia, he talks about seeing railway carriages that have got the notation on there of SAR. And by that he means South African Railways. And he also speaks of SA Spoorweg. Spoorweg is railways. So he gets to Zambia and he finds that there are all these trucks and carriages from South African Railways sitting in Zambia. Because the whites of South Africa and Rhodesia are still dealing with Zambia, even though Zambia is actually harboring all our enemies. What he doesn't tell you is that the Chinese built the Tanzam railway line, which was a railway line from Zambia to Tanzania, with the aim of getting Zambia out of being dependent on the whites of Rhodesia and South Africa. And that project was ultimately a failure. So communists actually came and built railways to try and make the blacks totally independent of white railways. And they failed ultimately. The Tanzam railway line was ultimately a failure. So the blacks were exporting all their copper through Rhodesia and South Africa. And it was going on to ships and going out into the rest of the world. But I suspect that economics was a big problem for the whites, including Rhodesia, and that maybe that explains why Rhodesia and South Africa allowed some of these things instead of actually fighting them. But later, the Rhodesian army spent a lot of time inside Zambia just killing black terrorists because the problem got so bad. But what it also shows is that the whites were dealing with other blacks. And South Africa, even during the time of apartheid, was dealing with blacks all across Africa, secretly. There were lots of blacks in Africa, black countries, who publicly would want nothing to do with apartheid and would criticize the whites of South Africa. But in private, they were doing deals with them. And the South Africans had a secret airline that traveled all across Africa and did all kinds of wheeling and dealing with these blacks. But in the end, all these blacks still stabbed the whites in the back. So whether it was worth doing these things for the blacks, I personally think it probably wasn't. Then another point that he raises, which is not really related to the war, is he talks about a woman called Bubbles Schroeder. And he talks about the fact that she was murdered. And when this girl was murdered, there were three Jews who were last seen with her. Now, Bubbles Schroeder is actually an Afrikaans girl, and she was murdered, I think, in about 1949. Now, this girl, Bubbles Schroeder, was an Afrikaans girl, and she became something of a, quote, good time girl. And she was hobnobbing and partying with people, including Jews. And she also spent some time living with Jewish men. Now, Bubbles Schroeder was murdered in 1949. Now, Ronnie Casrils mentions that when she was murdered, she was last seen with three Jews, and that the crime is unsolved, and that one of the Jews is still alive. And he mentioned in the talk that this Jew contacted him, and this Jew wants to write a book, apparently, I think, about Bubbles Schroeder and the murder, because this is now an unsolved murder. Now, those of you who are used to looking into Jewish crimes, you'll know that Jews have committed crimes and gotten away with them. An excellent example in the United States is the murder of Mary Fagan. And Mary Fagan was a young white girl who worked for a Jew. And Mary Fagan went to collect her $1.20 or so from the Jew, and then she was murdered. And when she was murdered, they established that she'd been molested sexually. And the Jew denied committing the crime. And the Jew even blamed a black man who worked for him. But the Jew was later lynched by Americans after he'd gone on trial and been found guilty. But the reason they went and lynched him was because all the Jews and powerful Jews all across America were gathering together to try and get this Jew off the hook of the crime of murder, of which he'd been found guilty. They were going to have this whole thing rolled back. So some senior Americans basically took the law into their own hands, knowing that even though he's gone to trial, been found guilty, these Jews are going to organize it, that he's going to get off the hook. So then some high-ranking guys organized the seizure of this Jew, and they went and killed him. They lynched him. And I have no problem with that, because he'd been on trial, he'd gone through the proper process, he had been found guilty, and the Jews were now using their political connections to try and roll things back and get him off the hook. And you will know from the Jewish Talmud that if a Jew commits a crime against a non-Jew, including a murder, the Jews don't regard it as a crime. So it is very suspicious that in South Africa, that when Bubbles Schroeder died, she was last seen with three Jewish men. I went and I did a little bit of research into it, and it turns out that when she was found dead in Orange Grove, I think it was, all the areas that she was involved in and traveled through were places where Jews lived. Just like you heard in the discussion, Yeovil, and Orange Grove is right next to Yeovil. All of these are Jewish suburbs in South Africa, or used to be Jewish suburbs. Some of them are now black. Anyway, the bottom line is that when the police at the time investigated this, they found that really there were only three people who could be linked to her murder, and it was the three Jews who'd been with her the night before. So the South African police basically made a case and took this thing to court, saying that these three Jews, either one or more of them, were involved in the crime. But in the end, the Jews got off the hook. And so this remains an unsolved murder in South Africa. But like I say, all the circumstantial evidence pointed to the fact that it had to be those Jews. One or more of them was involved in it. She was actually dropped off at a place and she was found murdered not far from that place, and one of the Jews had said he'd taken her and dropped her off on a road nearby. So now one of those three Jews is still alive. All of those Jews went on to become very wealthy in South Africa, and I came across mention that one of the Jews owned a company, and somebody in that company discovered fraud. And then what happened was the person who had discovered the fraud in the Jew's company, that person was murdered, and I think also an unsolved murder. So there have been suspicions in South Africa that a Jew, at least one or more Jews, was involved in the murder of Bubbles Schroeder. But now this final remaining Jew is going to write a book. So you can bet your bottom dollar the Jew is busy, and he's going to try to mislead people away from the Jews. Jews themselves cover up each other's crimes. And I strongly suspect, from what I've been reading, I strongly suspect that many people in South Africa who looked into the Bubbles Schroeder case were quite convinced that Jews were involved in it. But Jews are very careful to hide their crimes. And you get the same thing with Jack the Ripper, for example. Jack the Ripper was a Polish Jew. And the British police concluded that it was a Polish Jew, and they put him into an insane asylum. And once they did that, the British police were so convinced they had their man that they stood down all their policemen from the areas where the murders had taken place, because they were so convinced they'd gotten the murderer. And after they'd put this guy away in an insane asylum, there were no more Jack the Ripper murders in London. But you won't hear anybody in the mass media coming out and talking about this stuff. It's all hushed up. And I even came across instances where people actually had DNA from that time, and they had it tested, and it actually pointed to this Jew. And another weird thing about Jack the Ripper is that the British put the crime records relating to Jack the Ripper, they classified it and held it in secret for 100 years. 100 years. You'll find a similar thing with the John F. Kennedy assassination. My own suspicion is that any time Jews are involved in some kind of killing, then you'll see all kinds of weird stuff as they try to hide it, try to use secrecy to stop the facts from getting out to the public, etc., etc. So my suspicion is that Bubbles Schroeder in South Africa is an example of Jews who murdered a white girl, and the Jews are making sure that the evidence apparently exonerates them. They will go to great lengths. And just like with Mary Fagan in America, the Jews have been lying about Mary Fagan for over 100 years. Rest assured, they'll do the same on the Bubbles Schroeder issue. Last year, before I went to America, I was looking through various books that I had to do with crimes and atrocities to see if there were any things that I could spot that related to Jews. And actually, in a book on South African crimes, I found two murders that were related to Jews that were very interesting. One had to do with an Afrikaans woman who murdered a Jew that she'd married, and the reason she murdered him was because he basically had set her up so that she would lose her farm, which was her only source of income. And then there was another fascinating case of a Jew in Johannesburg whose wife was mysteriously murdered. The Jew claimed that blacks did it, but there was no evidence pointing to the blacks. This was under apartheid, and the police did look into the issue of whether blacks had murdered the Jew's wife, and they found no evidence. The evidence only seemed to relate to this Jew, and this Jew went to unbelievable lengths to make up all kinds of stories, weird, weird stories. So those were two stories that I came across that I thought at some point I will make a video about those two cases, because they're very interesting, especially the one where the Jew must have murdered his own wife. That one is really interesting, and it was in Johannesburg. And also, just like Bubbles Schroeder, ends up being a case of nobody can find the perpetrator. The perpetrator disappears. But in that particular case, the guy was very wealthy, and there were many weird, weird, weird things in that case. And I suspect that he murdered her. Jews are very touchy on issues like murder because of things that happened in Europe in the past, and they know that if Jews are implicated, people start looking at them more closely. And so they go to tremendous lengths to hide things where they were involved in, because they know it will piss white people off. And just for the record, in Europe, for a long time in Europe, Jews were regarded as so unreliable as witnesses. They used to lie so much in court that for a long period of time in Europe, Jewish testimony was not allowed in a court of law. Jews were regarded as such arrant liars. Another thing that Ronnie Casrils talks about is he talks about being sent to the boss. This is when he's at school. And when he talks about the boss, he's talking about the headmaster. So he's saying that he's sent to the headmaster for cuts. And cuts is when they cane you. When I was a kid at school in Rhodesia, we also had cuts. We also used the term cuts. And it was for when the headmaster or a male teacher canes you. He goes on and on about what a hideous thing it was in South Africa and how terrible it was and how nasty it was, and he got the cuts and he was bleeding and he had to hide it from his mother for weeks and so on. And he speaks about the injustice of the system in South Africa. And I must tell you, I think that this is yet another case of overblown Jewish moaning. Moaning and groaning about things that whites do naturally. That this is the system among whites. This is how our teachers used to keep discipline. We were rowdy. I was in a boys' school. Boys can be very naughty. And we got cuts. I only went and got caned twice. The one time, the entire class, since we were a class of boys, the entire class had been naughty, and I think a female teacher sent us to the vice headmaster, and he caned everyone in the class. Everyone in the class got a caning. And another time I got a caning. I can't remember what I did wrong, but I got caned another time. I was generally quite well behaved, actually. But this stuff was normal, and we didn't go and cry about these things, and we didn't turn around and say our teachers were scum and that the system was evil. It was a case of meting out justice to the boys who are unruly. I don't see anything wrong with it. I doubt the teachers were pedophiles. I think the way that he describes it is typical overblown Jewish nonsense. I'm sure that lots and lots and lots of the older generation of men all got caned at school, and nobody cries about it. But notice how he talks about it, and that it leads to injustice and blah, 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 the injustices of the time of apartheid, you know, and it starts in school and these people are really pedophiles and all that. I think it's a lot of overblown nonsense. One thing I can tell you about my time in South Africa, under white rule, I certainly never got the impression that the whites were out to have an unjust society. The whites here in South Africa, like whites everywhere, were doing their damnedest to do things honestly and to have a just system. And whatever faults and flaws that system may have had, I can tell you it's 1,000 times better than under Black rule. Notice that Ronnie Casrils also said that he enjoys getting a chance to talk to whites and that whites are so serious. Well, it sort of implies that blacks are not as serious, hey? So he says he likes to speak to whites and whites are so serious and looking for information. But of course, he spent his whole life working with blacks against whites. I don't believe that any of what he's saying is true. I think that everything he says needs to be put under a microscope, which is why I'm making these commentaries as well. Just to warn you about some of the things he's saying and some of the impressions he's creating, because I don't think that they are all accurate. Notice also his descriptions of what a memoir is, and he says that a memoir cannot be regarded as real history, that there can be all kinds of things in there due to faulty memory. He actually goes on quite at length about how a memoir is not exactly accurate history. Well, I'm sure that anybody who writes a memoir certainly tries to make it as accurate as possible, but it's interesting that he goes on and talks about how inaccurate it can be. So that raises some questions for me. Notice also how he said that he doesn't have that hatred towards whites when he talks about the blacks going and slaughtering the whites, especially the Afrikaans-speaking whites. And he says, well, you know, we communists, we're not really like that. And then he says, but some of us are. But I don't have all that hatred, he says. Yeah. Jewish communism has killed more people on earth than any other political system. They have murdered at least 100 million people. There are those who have also looked at it and said that they've actually murdered 200 million people. These numbers make World Wars 1 and 2 look like a walk in the park. Nobody has murdered more people than Jewish communists, I tell you. So him saying, oh, I don't have that hatred, etc. But you spent your entire life working against the whites. Now you want to say that you don't have that hatred. You spent your entire life working against the whites. Notice also how he explains how his mother told him things and warned him of the things to say to the other Christian children when he was at school. His mother advised him and said, when the other children tell you that the Jews killed Jesus, you must tell them that the Romans killed Jesus. And he says there, but I didn't even know who the Romans were. So that gives you an example of how these Jews educate their children. And they're already preparing their children to defend Jews and to have the correct lies to tell. So that thing about his mom advising him, tell them the Romans killed Jesus. Jews are fully aware of all their crimes. They are fully aware of the perceptions of the Christians and other whites. They know it and they do their utmost to hide it. I found it interesting when he mentioned Jacob Zuma the Zulu and he spoke about Jews who don't intermarry outside their community, and he spoke about Zulus and other tribes also not marrying people of other tribes and races. So you see, that proves that lots of people, including blacks, have a firm commitment to their own race. And South Africa's got 11 different tribes, and if you really look at it closely, the whites and apartheid and what the whites were preaching was not that much out of step with even the way that blacks view themselves. However, it's these Jews who are constantly harping on the evils of apartheid. And finally, when his mother talks to him about the gas chambers and racism, and she's talking about that beating of the black guy by the whites. Notice how he relates it to the treatment of the Jews in Europe. And his mother's saying, well, you see, son, it starts like this. And if they don't stop it, then it just gets worse. You see, here we are stuck with the problem of Jews in Europe and the Jews having been chased out and the pogroms of the whites against the Jews in Europe on hundreds of occasions, where Jews have gone and irritated the whites or committed crimes against the whites, and the whites grow sick and tired of them. Now these Jews have left Europe, and they've come to South Africa, they've come to Australia and Argentina and Canada, and the vast majority of them went to America. Those Jews are bringing with them their baggage from Europe, and they are using their European experiences against other whites. And it shows that they clearly know that all whites are the same. And this explains also why Jews who've left Europe have been pushing all this racial stuff and interracial stuff and helping the blacks and using the blacks as a tool against the whites. This is basically a rerun of Europe, except that the Jews have moved to a new place, and before the whites get round to sorting these Jews out, the Jews already know that the clash is coming between them and the whites, and the Jews are already preemptively attacking the whites. That is really what it boils down to. And so his mother said to him, well, Ronald, we don't have gas chambers in South Africa, but it starts like this. Well, I also want to add to this that there weren't gas chambers in Europe either. There were no gas chambers in Germany. There were no gas chambers in Poland. In fact, there were no gas chambers anywhere in Europe. On my website and my channels, I've not gone and put out all the stuff that I have about the Holocaust. I've got tons of stuff. And I spent a couple of years looking into the Holocaust the moment that I realized that this Jewish issue is real. Once I realized in 2012 that Jews and whites really have got a clash between them, and I had begun to understand it, I must have spent 2 to 3 years doing nothing but looking into Holocaust stuff, and I gathered together lots of Holocaust videos and footage and details. And I've only actually put out one video of the hundreds that I've made. I've only put out one video that deals with a portion of the Holocaust. It was something that I discovered that had been put on Canadian TV. That there was an interview with somebody on Canadian TV, a fantastic lawyer actually, who was defending Ernst Zundel, and the man on whose show he appeared on Canadian TV then said, well, we're going to show you people that the Holocaust was real. So after he debated this lawyer, he then said, we're going to show you that the Holocaust was actually real. And they put out some film footage on Canadian TV. And when I looked at the film footage closely, I realized that you're not looking at dead Jews here. In fact, this has got nothing to do with the so-called Holocaust. Because remember, the Jewish version of the Holocaust is that 6 million Jews were gassed to death by the Germans. And in actual fact, if you look at any photo footage of the Holocaust, whatever photos you can find, or whatever photos and film footage they put out, you will never at any time see gas chambers, and you won't see the dead bodies of Jews who were gassed to death. In fact, there is not even a single autopsy of a single Jew who ever died. Even now, more than 75 years after World War II, there has never been even a single instance of an autopsy of a Jew from World War II who was found to have died of gassing. If the Germans killed millions of Jews and the Jews all claim that they know where they are buried, it is a very simple matter to dig there and to pull out all those bodies and to start the process of doing autopsies, examining how old were the Jews, what was their state of health, proof that they died of cyanide poisoning from the gas, etc., etc. None of this has ever happened. It's not ever been done because there is no physical evidence for it. And if you look very closely at these Jewish stories include stories that attempt to explain why there is no physical evidence. All these Jews who wrote about the Holocaust, for example, also include lots of stuff about the burning of corpses and cremation. Well, why are they making such a big issue about cremation? Well, it's to explain the lack of physical evidence, that there are no bodies there. And you will find this again and again in all these Jewish stories, that they go on and on about this burning, and everybody who's looked into the cremation issue knows that it's totally impossible. The Germans would have had to bring train loads with mountains of coal in order to burn these bodies. And also, by the way, all of this is at variance with what the Jewish authors actually write. All these great authors and scholars who wrote about the so-called Holocaust, their writings conflict with the reality, and there is no physical evidence to substantiate it. And even at places like Auschwitz, where they claim that they were murdered, Allied aircraft flew over Auschwitz many times during World War II. American and British planes flew over those places at the time of the so-called Holocaust, and never at any time did any of their film footage reveal that there were mass burials and cremations in progress. There was no evidence for any of that. And also, if you were taking the Jews to a place to kill them, why are there so many buildings at that place? Why, for example, does Auschwitz have so many buildings where Jews were housed? If your goal is to kill them, why did you build places for them to stay in? And why also did you take them to a place that is right next to a factory? And the factory at Auschwitz, I think, produced synthetic rubber. So Auschwitz was a place where the Germans produced, I think, synthetic rubber because of the sanctions against them, and they couldn't get rubber from elsewhere in the world. So, being the normal creative Germans that they are, they invented a way to create synthetic rubber, and they made rubber for themselves. And that is what they used the Jews for at that particular location. So anyway, whenever they show evidence of the Holocaust, you will always see these piles of dead bodies, and all these dead bodies are people who look like skeletons. And they will tell you, oh, these are the terrible atrocities of the Germans. But there are no Jews who are saying that the Germans starved them to death. If you are gassed, you don't turn into a skeleton, you drop dead. In fact, for the record, you not only drop dead, but your body turns a bright red color. If you die from cyanide poisoning, your body turns bright red. Nowhere in the documents and books written by the Jews do they ever point out that the bodies are supposed to have turned red. You'll have all these Jews who claim to be eyewitnesses who saw these other Jews being killed, and never at any time do any of them remark that the people have turned bright red. So that shows that they didn't see what they claim they saw. And the bodies that you see, when you see all these skeletons of people, What they don't tell you is that the Allies, the British and Americans, destroyed all of Germany's infrastructure. The British and American aircraft flew over Germany by the thousands. They were blowing up railway lines. They were destroying everything that was moving by road. They were blowing up bridges. What they don't tell you is that in the final months of World War II, that all the people in Germany were busy starving to death. And they were starving to death because of Allied, especially American and British aircraft, cutting off their food supplies. So when you see all those pictures of all these skeletons of people who died from starvation or who are almost ready to die from starvation, that is at the end of World War II, and it's because they didn't get food. Never at any time did the Jews say that the Germans starved them to death. The lie is that the Germans gassed them to death. But all the photographs you will see of these people are of thin, emaciated people who were starving or did starve to death. And so going back to the film footage that I saw that came from Canadian TV, in that case, I saw dead bodies lying next to railway tracks. That also does not match with the Jewish story of being gassed to death. Why are all these dead people lying next to a railway line, and why are some of them lying inside the trucks on railway tracks? So that is the only one that I did a video about, and I think it's time I re-released that one so that people can see that for themselves. Because I thought I'd quickly point out to people, here is yet another example of somebody pushing a lie, in this case Canadian TV pushing the lie of the Holocaust is real, and the film footage they're putting up has got absolutely no relation to the lie that the Jews are telling. And in recent months, while I was looking through another book, I was also looking through another crime book that I've got, a book about mass atrocities, I came across yet another Holocaust story that I think is worthy of a video, where a single Jewish woman claims to be the only survivor of a massacre that Germans perpetrated in Russia. And I'm not going to tell you more about that. I need to make a video about it, because in there, in writing, you will see that this is total nonsense. Complete nonsense. Jews invent lies as they need. And that one is a particular one that nobody else has pointed out that I also want to put out on a video. But to be honest with you, I don't do much on the Holocaust simply because there are other things that are of greater importance to me. But if we ever need to, I can tell you now that we could easily spend 20 to 30 hours doing nothing but studying Holocaust analyses by lots of different people with all kinds of different technical skills who've gone to the camps, who've gone and investigated this thing from every conceivable angle. And it is very easy to show that the entire Holocaust lie is nothing more than a figment of the Jews' imagination. We could very easily spend 20 to 30 hours watching nothing but Holocaust videos. And you'll be able to see everything from every conceivable angle, including listening to the Jews themselves who claimed that they were there and who now have to explain why it is that they are alive and that they weren't killed by the Nazis. All of that is there. There's tons of it, mountains of it. And on Amazon, they recently banned and removed more than 200 books, including technical studies by chemists and by experienced investigators who went and dug into this Holocaust nonsense, and they can prove to you that this stuff never took place. So Kaz Rules is quite quick there. Oh, well, you see, we don't have gas chambers in South Africa, but Well, just to make it clear, there were no gas chambers in Germany either, or anywhere in Europe. That's all that I want to make you aware of. And of all the lies told about the Germans, this is the most persistent one. This is the one that has been the most thoroughly investigated by masses of people. Whites from different countries, some are Germans, many are non-Germans. They've all looked into this, and let me tell you that there is no evidence for that stupid nonsense. And just to tell you that in South Africa at one point, in the South African Parliament, a black from the ANC said in Parliament, so it should be on the record of Parliament from the past, there was a black who said in Parliament that the whites of South Africa killed millions of blacks, that apartheid killed millions of blacks. Anybody who lives in South Africa knows that that is a total lie. Yet it's been said in Parliament and there is no evidence for that whatsoever. So those are just some comments about this nonsense of, well, Ronald, there are no gas chambers in South Africa, but there were no gas chambers in Germany or Poland or Europe at all. However, there are hundreds of Holocaust museums, including multiple Holocaust museums in South Africa, and millions of school children across the world are taken to all these Jewish Holocaust museums all across the world, and they are told all about these horrible Germans and how they gassed people to death. And it's total nonsense. It is a lie that Jews are pushing on kids in every country, including South Africa, including black children as well, are also being told about these nasty Germans and how they were holocausting Jews in the gas chambers. All Jewish nonsense. So I thought I'd just add these comments on regarding the many, many topics that came up during that talk, and just to clarify some things, especially for people outside South Africa. I just want to show you a couple of quick photos of Ronnie Casserolls, and I just want to show you that this guy is no lightweight. And also, just want to show you a little something that he didn't mention in his book, or in his talk, rather. I've got more photos of him. We can have a good look at him a little bit later. But I want to show you this about Casserolls. So here is a photo I took at the book launch, or at the book review. It wasn't so much a launch as a review. Another photo of him. He's actually very old and he's actually quite weak. He shakes a lot. So he's very old and he's shaking a lot. And here he is talking. Just to show you, this was his first book, his memoirs, Armed and Dangerous, which came out in the 1990s. There he is showing it to his buddy, Fidel Castro, communist shitbag. Here is Joe Slovo. Joe Slovo, the top communist Jew, the Jew who ran all the liberation wars in Africa. Many people in South Africa don't even know this. Joe Slovo was the number one guy in the liberation wars in Africa. According to South African and Rhodesian intelligence, he was a colonel in the KGB of the Soviet Union. A colonel. And there is Casserolls with him. So there you got two Jews working against the whites. Slovo later became the Minister of Housing, and they didn't say much about him. They kind of kept his critical role out of the eye of the South African public. So those who weren't in the military and didn't know the real history, they didn't know that Slovo on the left is your number one Jew communist. And there's your number two Jew communist, Ronnie Casserolls, man. Right there. Jews have been working hard behind the scenes to get the blacks to kill the whites. This is his book, Armed and Dangerous. I think this was the first edition. I think I got the second edition because the cover is different. But look at this. Look at him. His victory sign. And what is that on his chest there? Is that the Soviet hammer and sickle? Huh? The hammer and sickle of the Soviet Union? Yeah, there you have your... Here's your modern day Jewish communist, Jewish Bolshevik, exactly the kind of enemy that Adolf Hitler and the Germans fought against. And anybody who says America's fought communism, Britain's fought communism, that's just little child's play. That's child's play, it's baby stuff, it's nothing. The real communist killers were the Germans and the Italians. The Germans were the greatest communist killers of all time. Adolf Hitler, the greatest communist killer who ever lived. Jewish Bolshevism, that is what they called it. And they said, this system of Jewish Bolshevism must be destroyed. So, in the talk, Ronnie Kasrolls was saying, oh, well, you see, I was only involved in, like, political education. I was only involved in political education. Nah. Take a look at this. Here is the white boy. Hey, here's the white boy among the blacks. And there's your one Jewish soldier from South Africa, because the Jews, they don't really fight. They're too busy making money and sneaking around. So here's their one Jewish soldier, Ronnie Kasrolls, among the blacks. And what is that, a submachine gun that he's holding there, semi-automatic or automatic in his hands? Ronnie Kasrolls was the founder, was among the founders of MK, which is not MK Ultra to do with the CIA. MK is the South African abbreviation for Umkhonto Sizwe, the spear of the nation, the army that fought against the whites. There's your man, there's your Jew, right in the middle of them. He was busy blowing up stuff in the 1960s in the Durban area, because that's where he lived at the time. So there's your classic Jewish commie. Now, the Germans in Russia were busy shooting up partisans, and partisans were people like that. And then, during this discussion, at the end of the discussion, we had a cup of tea. So my friend who had invited me to this, my supporter who'd invited me to this, the two of us went and we sat in the garden and we were having our cup of coffee. And I looked at the back of the house and I said, what the heck is that? And I'm looking at this thing and I said to her, I've got to go and take a photograph of this thing. And so I snuck around to the side and I took this photo. Here at the back of this Jewish woman's house is this ANC poster. And it says, thank you, Tata, for our freedom. And there it says, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela. And then it says, ANC. ANC is the ruling party of South Africa, African National Congress, Joburg region. Here is the close-up. Here is a close-up of the same thing. And there it says, thank you, Tata, for our freedom. On the back of the house of a Jewish woman, okay? Oh, thank you, Tata, for our freedom. These Jews were free under apartheid. They were given all the same benefits as the whites. Yet here, they are saying, oh, thank you for our freedom. What the hell is this? On whose side are you? Do you see what I'm getting at here? So no white would have a poster like this, but here it is sitting on the back of the Jewish house, the same place where Kasrolls was talking. Thank you, Tata. Tata must be some name for Nelson Mandela. Oh, thank you for our freedom from those horrible whites of apartheid. And it's on the back of a Jewish woman's house. So there you have it. On whose side are the Jews, my friends? They're not on the side of the whites, I tell you. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.